secret chord that David plays, and it pleases the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this: the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. From your lips she drew the hallelujah, 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 God above. As for me, all I ever learned from love is how to shoot at someone who outdrew you. But it's not a cry that you hear tonight. It's not some pilgrim who claims to have seen the light. No, it's a cold and it's a very broken hallelujah. Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. I remember when I moved in you, and the holy dove, she was moving too, and every single breath that we drew was hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Done my best, I know it wasn't much. I couldn't feel, so I learned to touch. I've told the truth, I didn't come here to London just to fool you. And even though it all went wrong, I'll stand right here before the Lord of Song with nothing, nothing on my tongue. Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, November 14th, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140, and our participant code is 385-698. Now, I did get a message tonight, and Gerard reminded me just a minute ago, that this number is going to be changing on the 17th. So we will repost the new number, we'll post the new number up on the website. We'll probably send an email out to all our membership to let them know that our Monday night call has changed. So we'll get that word out. I don't remember what the word is, what the number is. Maybe Gerard remembers. Do you know what it was, Gerard? If you want to just read it off, or Jen?
No, I don't look at they when you dial in, they give it to you, but I didn't write it down. I didn't get it.
I have it.
You got it. It's
712-770-4160. That's
repeat that again.
712-770-4160.
Okay, and we will get an email out on that, and we will post it on the website on our Monday night call-in. Okay, if anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions in to questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Maybe everyone could mute up because we're getting a little bit of an interference out here. Anyway, you can mail your questions into questions, plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website or at our store, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right side and donate. Everyone should be donating. We're at a critical point in time. We're going to be talking about that tonight. And we really need some money to really start to do the things we need to be doing. This is the time to get busy. We have to take the opportunity. Tonight's scripture reading is Psalms chapter 14, verses 1 through 23. Psalms chapter 14, verses 1 through, 23. Now, I'm not going to interpret this. This is a prophecy, and I'm not really going to interpret it, but I am going to probably give the meanings of a few words here. And being a student of the Bible for over 35 years, you know, I'd like to share some of the thoughts and understanding of some of these words so we have a better understanding of scriptures. You know, this is a Bible verses that is focusing in on the end of the world, the end of time, or very close to the end of time anyway. To make a point concerning Jacob, in chapter 23 of Genesis, Jacob wrestled with God, the Bible tells us. And after he wrestled with God, God blessed him and changed his name to Israel. And that is a picture of an individual that has become born again. We're all Jacobs until we become born again, those of us who are looking into the Word of God and trying to live a moral and an upright life, trying to live just and to do the right thing. And so when we start to come to the Lord, we come as Jacob. But at some point in time, we become born again. God creates us in us a new heart and renews a right spirit in us. Okay, so it's important to understand that when we're reading the scripture here tonight on Isaiah 14, who Jacob is and who Israel is. Israel is my son, so the Bible says. So Jacob's name turned to Israel, and God says, Israel is my son. Isaiah chapter 14, verse 1. For the Lord will have mercy on Jacob, and will yet choose Israel, and set them in their own land, and the strangers shall be joined with them, and they shall cleave to the house of Jacob. And the people shall take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel shall possess them in the land of the Lord for servants and handmaids. And they shall take them captive, whose captives they were. And they shall rule over their oppressors. And it shall come to pass in the day that Jehovah shall give thee rest from thy sorrow, from thy fear, and from that hard bondage wherein thou wast made to serve, that thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how hath the oppressor ceased? The golden city ceased. Jehovah hath broken the staff of the wicked and the scepter of the rulers. And by the way, the staff of the wicked and the scepter of the rulers identifies with spiritual power and political power. And God breaks them at the end of the world. These rulers, the wickedness, the wicked rulers. Let me reread that verse. The Lord hath broken the staff of the wicked and the scepter of the rulers. He who smote the people in wrath with a continual stroke, he that ruled the nation in anger is persecuted and none hindereth. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth in singing. Yea, the fir trees rejoice at thee, and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since thou art laid down, no fella, no tree cutter, the fella is a tree cutter, no fella is come up against us. Hell from beneath is moved for thee to meet thee at thy coming, to stir up the dead for thee, even all the chief ones of the earth. It hath raised up from their thrones all the kings of the nations, and they shall speak and say unto thee, art thou also become as weak as we? Art thou become like unto us? Thy pomp is brought down to the grave, and the noise of thy vials. The worm is spread under thee, and the worms cover thee. And this, of course, is the slaying of Leviathan. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground that didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend unto the heavens. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit. They that see thee shall narrowly look upon thee and consider thee, saying, Is this the man or men that made the earth to tremble, that did shake kingdoms, that made the world as a wilderness and destroyed the cities thereof, that opened not the house of his prisoners? All the kings of the nation, even all of them, lie in glory, every one in his own house. But thou hast cast out of thy grave like an abominable branch, and as a raiment of those that are slain, thrust through with a sword, and go down to the stones of the pits as a carcass trodden under feet. Thou shalt not be joined with them in burial, because thou hast destroyed thy land and slain thy people. The seed of evildoers shall never be renowned. Prepare slaughter for his children, for the iniquity of their fathers, that they do not rise nor possess the land, nor fill the face of the world with cities. For I will rise up against them, saith the Lord of hosts, and cut off from Babylon the name and remnant, the sons and nephews, saith the Lord. I will also make it a possession for the bitten and the pools of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, saith the Lord of hosts. I may read just a couple of other verses. The Lord of hosts hath sworn, saying, Surely as I have thought, so shall it come to pass, and as I have purposed, so shall it stand. Okay, that was Isaiah chapter 14, verses 1 through 24 we read. Okay, I read those verses because I think we're nearing this time of judgment upon the nations. The Bible has a lot to say about that, and I think that's where we're at, the time that nations will be judged. And that, of course, has to happen before God judges the individuals of the world. Okay, tonight we're going to talk a little bit about what we're doing, where we're going, and what's going on. Last Tuesday was a big day. We know that Trump was elected president, and this brings a great opportunity, and I do believe that he is going to fulfill what he is saying. He wants to make America great again. We've had some communications with his camp through a proxy. We have delivered his papers. They were interested in our papers. We've delivered our papers that we've been filing in the courts and what was going on out there in Oregon to the Trump camp, and we're working now to try to get a direct communications with Trump, you know, his camp, his the people, and we're going to include him in our court case. We're preparing, as we've been talking about for weeks now, we're preparing a court case. So I think next week we'll have a paper to read. We're working diligently on these papers, but we have to make sure we get it right. They're kind of a little bit difficult to write, you know, because we're doing something that has never been done before. The pieces of what we're doing has been done, but what we are doing as in a total has never been done before. We're going to be filing this case up in Albany. And this case is going to be ultimately a redress of grievances. We're not asking them. We're telling them this is our unalienable right, and this is what this court case is about, and you need to answer. And again, we talked a little bit about this, but I'll just repeat this. We're going to address directly the United States Supreme Court and the 8 justices up there. They are responsible for the actions of the federal courts, and the federal courts are a mess. Justice is not possible in those courts unless you can corner these judges, and you'll get justice on the side, possibly, if you can corner these judges and put them on on the spot and put them at risk and file their sins in their court. Then you might be able to get some justice. But again, they don't want these cases recorded. The Bar Association has taken over our courts, and they've had control of our courts for quite some time. They have committed treason. They have subverted our Constitution. They've subverted the law of the land, and they've done away with it. And these judges are applying their law, which is no law at all. They're applying lawlessness. But anyway, we're going to go and go after the boss, their boss, which is the United States Supreme Court. We're going to command them that they need to fix this problem in the courts and bring back the common law and order these people to do so. We're also going to go to both houses of Congress. We're going to address both the Senate and the Congress. And we have a lot to say to speak about them. And again, I think next week we'll hopefully be reading the papers that we're writing right now for the Senate and Congress. We were not going to address the administration unless Trump was elected, because the administration, you know, it's worthless to talk to them. They're controlled by an oligarchy. They're just not going to even consider anything that we have to say. But now we have an opportunity, and we're going to try to open up a dialogue. We're going to send to Trump as the president to be. We'll address him as Mr. President. We're going to really pretty much give him an information to bring him up to par, so to speak, of all of the things we've been talking about in the courts, and copy all the things we're going to be filing in the courts, which will be an education for him. Donald Trump does not really know the Constitution well, but he knows it probably as much as the mainstream, maybe a little more than mainstream America, you know, in the sense that they want to have liberty, they want to have certain unalienable rights, and they believe certain things that are clear, you know, freedom of speech. Very few people really understand the unalienable right of the Second Amendment. I mean, that it shall not be infringed. If there is one step to be put in front of an individual in order to be able to get a weapon, then their right has been infringed. And we got to make this clear to people. We have to really get the Constitution out there. If we, the people, do not become educated, then we are seeking liberty and freedom, which we will never receive. If the people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen. We have to understand the Constitution. And so really, you know, our quest is really to get the word out to the people, to get people to become educated. And right now we don't need everyone to become educated, but clearly those who are going to be leading, we need to become educated. And we need to start really hammering and working on the administrations for the grand and the trial juries. We've got a lot of people who have signed up for courses, and some of them haven't finished, and they've checked the box to become administrators. And they haven't finished the courses. We have some people, of course, who have finished the courses. We're going to start making contact with those people and start to organize those people to see how serious they are and remove their name from the list if they're not interested. But we need four people in every county. We have 3,143 counties, so you do the multiplication, you know, 12,000. We're going to need about 15,000 people, roughly, okay, because some counties are large, will have a high population, so they'll need more than four, but every county needs at least four administrators. And of course, this is a paid job. It's a professional job, and anybody interested in taking on this position, as soon as we're in a position to be able to take these positions, you know, we need to be training for this. We have written a jurist handbook, which we've updated. Now, it's kind of what we posted right now is still preliminary in the sense that it's a draft. It's pretty much done, but we're going through it right now to correct the, punctuation and maybe some spelling or whatever errors we might have in there. We're also going to restructure, if you look at the index or the table of contents, I believe we changed the name to the table of contents, which I think is the second page. you know, we're going to be changing that structure in a different order. But pretty much this is it. I wanted to get it out there so people can start looking at it. Things are moving fast, so we need to start moving fast. The opportunity, we can't afford to lose this opportunity. We have to really press ahead and take advantage of the opportunity that is before us. We need to get the word out to get those who have been connected and maybe aren't so much connected anymore, get them reconnected, make them to understand this is the last chance we have. We can save America. We haven't hit critical mass yet, but our motions and our movements towards doing the things we have to do and the preparation and getting the excitement going and getting the education, the learning going that we need to have in order to be able to do the things we need to do, this will create more and more energy and critical mass will be achieved. A lot of people are really starting to pull together to collectively to work with this new administration. There's a special website out there that Trump has where people can come communicate and, give their ideas, and they're going to be working with people to make America great again. Chris Ann Hall, we understand, has made contact with this opportunity through this website, and she is suggesting, if I understand this correctly, she is suggesting that they create a Department of Constitutional Education. Which is a new government agency, I don't know if there was, I thought I heard someone say something about creating another cabinet member that would hold this position, but I may be in error there. But this idea of creating a new government agency called the Department of Constitutional Education is a great idea, something we definitely need. But one of the problems with this is Donald Trump doesn't have the power or the authority to create any department at all. That's the job of Congress. Surely the Constitution provides for that kind of a office. And we're going to write something up and try to prepare some kind of a plan that maybe we can execute and work with Chris Ann Hall if she wants to work with us, and also with the Trump administration in order to get this kind of an idea moving through Congress. And so our court case is going to play a major role in trying to push that idea through. And that would be a huge, huge change and shift in our government if we're able to get together some kind of a department called the Department of Constitutional Education. Here in New York, it is the law that the Constitution and civics be taught to our children, and yet they're not teaching it. This would be the job of this particular agency, is to make sure that our government at all levels obey the law, and particularly the fact that we, the people, need to be educated. And we need to get a real education. We don't want a bar member education. We don't want these clowns teaching us about the Constitution, and they themselves don't even know it. And as a matter of fact, they're subverting it. So how can we trust them? So this is something we'll work out. We already do have a course, and those who aren't aware of it, we have a constitutional course on our website. It's free of charge. Just go up there and click on the button and sign up and take the course. We also have a civics course. I would suggest taking the constitutional course first, because you could do that in 6 to 8 hours. You could do that on a long, long Saturday or something. But you can get through that course pretty quickly. The other course is about 120 hours. It's a civics course. It's very in-depth, and it's very informative, and explains a lot of things, and explains exactly how we got to, how America has gotten to where we are today. It's really, I think, was a really good course put together. So anyway, those are two courses we put up. We're in the process, we've talked about this before, we're in the process of creating a handbook for administrators. And I think we may start a course, a special course, a live course possibly. I'm not sure how we're going to do this yet, if it's going to be live or not, but I think it might be. for the sole purpose of dealing and teaching and training administrators and anybody really who wants to get into this, to understand the court system and how it works, common law, and how the processes work. And so that's going to happen soon. And again, the handbook is the most important thing that we need to get done as soon as possible for those administrators when they take these positions, so that they'll know how to act and how to provide orientation for the juries, how to give advice to the juries, and how to be very careful not to taint those juries and not put forth our ideas and thoughts in cases that they're considering. We have to be very, very careful about that. But we need to give these people a mindset, and that can be accomplished in one day, which is generally what is given to the courts or any when they pull a jury together. There's an orientation. I don't know how many hours of that day they spend, but we'll spend at least 6 to 8 hours on that first day. We will create an orientation process for all of the jurors, and it will be more than sufficient for them to be able to come in as jurists and understand what job there really is before them, whether they're grand jurist or trial jurist. But they will understand the principles, the fundamental principles of common law. We will give them a good understanding that they need to have a sense of honor, justice, and mercy. They will take a vow to God. If they don't want to take a vow to God, then they can't serve. And then it'll be up to the members of that jury to keep each other in check. You know, if someone breaks their vow, and the vow is basically that they promise to go forward and to judge this judgment with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy. And if they break those rules, it's up to the other 11 in the case of a trial jury, or 24 in the case of a grand jury, to make the correction and bring them back to these principles. But anyway, we need to get all these things together. We need to educate. We need to prepare. We'll also set up a system of advisory. The National Liberty Alliance will be an advisor to anyone that is in this process, and things will come up that's new, and we'll make sure we get the right information to the people, what they need, and that they will be able to provide the necessary services in order to get the juries up and moving. We need to understand that the people own this nation. They own this country. We are in charge of the government, and anybody, the grand jury is open to anybody. Anybody who wants to talk to the grand jury has the opportunity to talk to the grand jury. They can come in and get a meeting with them to bring a case that they have before the grand jury. It's our unalienable right to have access to that. Maybe someone has been doing, or a group of people have been doing some investigating, and they've got all this evidence, maybe about some things going on in government or some agency or whatever. We know that there's a lot of abuse on a lot of federal agencies out there. We know about the BLM. And even especially the IRS, okay, and many other agencies where they're abusing the people. You know, I'd like to put the word out. Anybody who has been abused, maybe in that way, by these agencies, maybe the SWAT team came out, they broke down their door, and they were arrested and drug out, and so on and so forth. Their rights have been violated, or they have been frightened away off of land, like what's going on out west, intimidated. people can do affidavits and get that to us. We definitely would like affidavits, anybody who's been intimidated in that way, and we'll get it into our court case. Our court case is going to focus in on a number of things. Of course, the first and foremost is to lay out the redress of grievances to all of these all three branches of government. And like I said, we're going to include Donald Trump in this. For him, it'll be mostly an information. But we're going to address some things to make sure he understands. This issue out there, I think, is in Montana with the Indians going across reservation land, which I now understand is not necessarily their land that they're going through at the pipelines, but it's going through public land that the Indians have their burial site on. And we can't let this happen, and Donald Trump can't let this happen. He needs to be able to negotiate this. These people, they need to go around. They can't violate these people. We've violated the Indians enough, and it's not we the people that done that. It's the government, the people that we've given trust in our government to run our government. Those are the people who have violated the Indians and many other people, and we need to stop it. We need to regain their trust back, but we'll discuss that issue at a later time. We've got about 30 or 35, or I don't know how many habeas corpus is out there, but we have quite a few. And again, only a couple of people have been set free. But now we're going to pull all of these cases into this court case. We're going to go after the chief judges, and they're going to give an account by what authority that they think that they can act by not acting. And we also are going to go after the clerks who have not filed these papers. And at some point in time, we'll start doing, we'll come after them and file, what do you call it? Can't think of the name of that. Anyway, we're going to go after these
people.
Indictments. I couldn't think of that word. Thank you. We're going to go out after them criminally. And we'll file indictments inside our court case, and we will operate the court case. We'll get a trial jury, and we're going to operate it. We need the marshals, who are the most ignorant of all of the court officers, when you're even more ignorant than the sheriffs. They need to understand the power and authority that they're under and what they need to be doing, the oath that they took. And we're going to make sure that in our court case, we're going to address this to Donald Trump, that he needs to order. He's got the power and the authority to order these marshals to obey the law and know the Constitution. If they don't know it, we're going to suggest send them to our site. We'll educate them for free, okay? But they need to understand the law, and they need to start arresting people when indictments go out. Okay, they need to understand their true power and authority. Right now, they work for the courts. And it was never meant to be that the marshals work for the court. They are the constitutional officers of the federal court. They're to make sure that the unalienable rights of the people are not violated. That is their primary directive, their primary focus. Of course, they have duties in the court to make sure they execute the duties of the court. The duties of the court being executed in justice and righteously benefits we the people, again, our unalienable rights of having courts of justice. And they need to understand this. We need to clarify this and define this and educate them. Donald Trump, again, as I mentioned, I've listened to him talk, he's got some errors in his thinking. He doesn't understand the Constitution in certain ways. We need to advise him. We need to educate him. We need to make it clear on how it is that he's violating the Constitution. His job as President of the United States, he wants to make America great again. Well, if he wants to make America great again, we need to make sure he understands that means us to return to our roots, which means we have to stand on the Constitution, which means he needs to understand the Constitution better. And we will offer to teach him, and our paperwork will teach them. Anybody who looks at our paperwork, and let me go up to the website, nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight grand jury, and come down to grand jury and click on docket. And that's where we're posting all of our papers right now, on this page called the docket. And again, we've got a lot of stuff up there. We've got law documents that will be involved in the case already. We started putting some documents up there. We have three papers already filed up there that we're going to be ready to file in the courts. And we have evidence documents. For a real education and what we the people are doing, what we the people need to know, especially those of us who are going to be leaders, those of us who are going to be administrators, those of us who are going to make sure that in our counties that the Constitution is being adhered to through the committees of safety on the grassroots level, those people need to educate, or somebody within their group needs to really get educated in these things. And the best way to educate yourself in these things is to read. Take the two courses and read our court cases. Our court cases is an education in itself. And again, I'm going to try to maybe get a course going soon. And again, I don't know how I'm going to do this, whether we're going to maybe create another course that's sort of animated the way we have the two courses now, or doing it live. I'd like to do it live and maybe set things up with homework where people will go and do some studying in a certain area, and we'll have questions and answers. And then when we come together the next week, we'll discuss those things and take questions on that and discuss it further and bring other pieces of information that will help build upon this and give us a better understanding. Again, if people expect to be ignorant and free, they expect what never was and never will be. We the people have to step up. We the people have to save America. No one else can do it. So if people are not getting up to do what has to be done to save this great nation, then we don't deserve it, and we're going to lose it. We have to do it. We have to go through our membership and rekindle, get everybody together. People need to become active. Now is the time. We have an opportunity like none other. I mean, I've listened. I turned on Alex Jones on the Wednesday and listened to the Wednesday program. And wow, you know, there's so much positive attitude and feeling of finally we're getting to a point where we can actually do something. We need to take advantage. These people are on the run. They are frightened. They have no clue on what to do. They are confused. And you know what? They're so focused and beat up on the election process, they're not even paying that much attention to us yet. And that may be by grand design, you know, but you know, we're in the courts, and the judges know we're there, and there's no better time to file papers than right now, because getting our papers in the court to really start beating them up again and putting their sins on paper and pressing the processes of the law and what we the people have the authority and the right to do, we're the owners of this nation. We are the source of all law in this nation. We wrote the Constitution. We decide we can make it null and void in a court of law. We can decide we don't like that law at all, and we're not going to use it. We may think a law is good, but in this case, it's not good. We're not going to use it in this case. You know, that's up to the people in the court, as far as the jurists are concerned. That's the power and the authority. All law comes from the people. And, of course, all true law comes from God. You know, we made a covenant with God when the Declaration of Independence was signed and filed. And we made that much, how would you say it, we certified it by our Constitution and by our Bill of Rights, the capstone. You know, we have unalienable rights. Unalienable rights means they come from the Maker, from our God, okay? If you don't have unalienable rights, then you have some other rights, and they come from some place, and the only other place it can come from is from man. So you have men, rights from men, and they can decide, if you live under that kind of rule, whether you'll have those rights tomorrow or today or next week or not. Or maybe they'll give it to this one and not to that one, if that's the kind of rule. That's where we're at right now anyway. But we have to get back under, you know, the law of God. But as far as writing the law for our government, we the people wrote law. That's the Constitution. That's the law we wrote for them. We the people wrote the Bill of Rights. We the people wrote the Declaration of Independence. That's law. That comes from us. And American jurisprudence, okay? Ultimately, that, of course, comes from God because it comes from natural law or common law. But generally speaking, we make declarations. We give the legislators the powers and authority to write certain law under a certain criteria within certain framework. You find that in Article 1. Section 8 or 9 of the Constitution. I think it's 8. Let me just take a quick look. But that's where, you know, the authority of their writing the law, but they can't come outside of that criteria. And again, to understand this, by reading our papers, you're going to understand all of this stuff because we go through this point by point, article by article. So it's Section 8 is really... the authorities, 18 powers we gave to Congress, and we were very specific and we were very clear. We did not put in there the authority or the power to write any law that governs our behavior. That's up to you and that's up to me. to make sure our behavior is correct. And when we violate and do something that is bad behavior that affects or injures another individual, then we will be held accountable for that. And Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution really gets into a lot of things that they cannot do, okay? For instance, in Article 9 of the Article 1, Section 9, Clause, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, okay? Clause 4 says no income tax. They cannot put an income tax on you, nor can they tax your property. How can your property be your property if every year you have to pay a tax on that, and if you don't pay that tax, they're going to take that property? It's not your property, is it? And they'll take it in a process called in rem, and in rem says that they had that property at one time in the past, and they're redeeming it. Or they're redeeming that property through a process they redeem it because, for instance, piracy, the piracy acts, you know. If they catch pirates at sea, they have the right to take
it. And recover it for themselves.
Right. Well, that's one part of it for the process of in rem. But also, they can take the property of pirates, okay, because that ship, for instance, they can seize the ship. And once they bring it into the harbor, whatever nation took it into that harbor and their harbor, then they've made a claim on the right of that because it's sort of an act of war. It's the pirates. But anyway, we need to understand the law of the land. And again, there's no better way to understand the law of the land, in my opinion, than to really start reading these papers that we've been writing. All of our papers that we've been writing in the past are going to become part of this court case, and we've written about 18 of them. So they eventually will show up on this page, and we'll start filing. I'd love to file within the next week or two. Again, it's a matter of being able to get it written, but it's also a matter of money. We don't have the money. This is going to cost thousands of dollars to get this process done and to get it done right. We have to add to this thing the marshals. We have to go out after the marshals individually and directly and to put them on the spot and to require them to give an account of what it is that they should be doing and what it is that they're doing, account of their stewardship. And then they need to answer this. But all that costs money. Every time we write a paper, it costs money. We got, of course, put it through the mail, print it out, and all this other stuff. So it's going to be thousands of dollars to do this. And if we don't get the money up, then we can't do it. And if we don't get the money up, and we can't do it. Then the people spoke. They don't want to save this nation. We really got to get a movement going. It's time for people to really, really get involved. No more sitting on the sidelines. Everybody has to get into it. We have the opportunity in the next 3 to 4 months, if we can push hard enough and get the people active and get these people on the run and get the marshals to start obeying the law and applying the law, we will take control of the federal courts. And overnight after that, we will take control of all of the Supreme Courts within every state, because the federal courts will require it because they have to obey the law of the land. And it is up to the federal courts to make sure the courts that are violating the law of the land to bring them into alignment with the law of the land. And those federal courts, we're not talking about judges doing that. We're talking about we, the people, through grand juries and through trial juries to make this process go. We need to do an indictment out here on out west here for these individuals that killed Lavoie Finnegan. We need to do an indictment. First, we need to do a show cause by what authority. This judge thinks that they can act. Judge Brown, I think her name was, out in Oregon. By what authority does she think that she can act, that she can forbid the people to bring the law into our courts of law, that they could not read the Constitution, that they could not read the Bible? They have to give us an account by what authority they think that they can do that. And then we need to go forward and consider indictments for these things. Conspiracy against we the people, subversion against the United States of America, high treason against we the people. And that's where we got to take this. and they have to answer. We need to go out to Montana and deal with the people out there and the problems with what they're doing with Mr. Robinson, okay? In jail, an elderly individual with medical needs, and he's not getting it, and he dug a hole. Big deal. What's he doing in jail, digging a hole? Ridiculous. What law did he violate? Matter of fact, he was all within his rights on that. But in any event, even if something was wrong, then he's got to pay restitution. You don't put a man in jail for digging a hole. It's ridiculous. And we deserve all this because we're not stepping up to doing the right thing. We're not educating ourselves. We're not stepping up and saying no. We're not pushing back. It's time to push back. We have, this is the time. It is clear. Okay, it is crystal clear. This is the time. All the stars, so to speak, are lining up. And the opportunity for the power and the authority when we write in the courts is so fantastic. I mean, it's been there now for a while. These people are frightened. They don't know what to do with this. But now, with this big political shift, this change that has taken place, they're really frightened. And what can they do? What are they going to do? You know, are they going to try to assassinate our new president? Is that what they're going to try to do? I don't think they're going to go that far at this point in time. I'm sure they have this is what they'd love to do at some point. But, you know, we need to get behind this guy, and we need to make sure that he obeys the Constitution. We need to educate him. We need to let them know that we, the people, are here, and we need to get into the courts. Gerard, do you want to pick up on some things here?
Well, I just wanted to reinforce something. You know, this Judge Anna Brown saying that she would not have the Constitution in her court, I don't know. I heard a number like 27 times or more than 27 times. Doesn't matter. 26, 27, 47.
What?
That's an important thing because if she thinks that there is something protecting her from doing that, if she thinks that she's in some kind of a corporate overlay that the Constitution is not allowed in and that she can function and that it's outside and she feels comfortable, let her explain that to the people. Let her explain where she's coming up with that the Constitution is null and void in certain cases or when somebody goes to proclaim it because he's claiming that they violated those rights, that she feels that she has the authority and the insulation to throw it out and not consider it. I mean, does she think that because she's a judge, she has unlimited discretion, even when she's, you know, on the law? When she's supposed to know the law. She's supposed to know the Constitution. She should know the Constitution before she knows any other law. And if she doesn't, she's got a problem. But whatever the reason is, she needs to answer for that. If they sent her some wayward judge's school and they told her in this situation you say that, then let her reveal us. If they brainwashed her into that you don't have the Constitution in the court because we're doing this or that or we got this magic thing that kicks it out or it's all about, you know, contract law and about money and this or that, I want to hear it from her. Let her expound upon with those things that she thinks that this smoke and mirror fiction is doing, that she's protected from the people to do that. And then let all the rest of them explain it. If she thinks she's protected and all the rest of them think they're protected, I want a list of everybody that thinks that that magic that they have, whatever they think that authority is that they're running now, that somehow can pick and choose what part of our law they obey or not. Or how it is that it's not in operation in that courtroom. I mean, is that another country? Is that a foreign country? That's not in our shores. It's some other place we stumbled into? Because that's what it is. It's a foreign jurisdiction. So, you know, we the people have to bring this and push it forward. It's a simple, it's an easy answer. She shouldn't have to think about it. You know, it's almost a yes or no. So I think that these things have been handed to us on a silver platter. I mean, what other time do you get a federal district court judge going 27 times, I will not have that Constitution in my court. Don't read that Constitution. No Constitution in my court. No, I would just like to get a collage of the of a tape of her saying it and just play it for the people. I think we should make a rap video of her going, no Constitution, in her own words. I mean, I think that would do more than anything to make her curl up and crawl in a hole. And you know what I mean? Because it's that
well,
serious.
Let's put that on our list of trying to get the audio on that, because there's audio on all this. Maybe
John,
Robert.
They're going to guard it with their lives if they had it. Look, if anybody knows.
Well, that's
how to,
okay. You know what? I think what we'll do is we'll subpoena it from our court case, won't we?
I'm hoping somebody secretly taped it and we can get. I don't care how we get it, but I'm just saying that it's so important in my mind for the people to understand. They may not want to read Article 1, Section this and all that stuff. You know, they need to, whether they want to or not. They may not understand it. It may hurt their head. But one thing they should understand is a judge going, get that Constitution out of court. Don't read that Constitution. I don't want that Constitution in my court. I mean, that's a powerful message she just gave us. She handed us this. Let's make her answer it. And everybody should be marching there with this on their lips. Come on. You know, this is a fundamental.
Do we have the transcript?
We've been kind of trying to work on that. As far as what we can get, I don't know.
Right, because I really
we
would like to get
have,
the transcript.
We definitely have
while
affidavits
working.
To that effect, but you know,
if we could get, I understand someone's out there got the transcript. We really got to get it. We got to wake these people up. They need to understand where they need to go. They could do whatever they want with this stuff, but they need to get it to us too. And we could take that transcript and we can go through that and we can create an audio concerning exactly this thing and make the point that this is what she said in the courtroom and put
right.
a you know this whole
absolutely.
String of
we
things.
We could create an audio from the transcript. We can even create a rap from the transcript if we had to. But what we need to find out is. Did they strike it from the transcript? Is there a problem with the transcripts? Because we have people that were there that wrote it down every time and counted it, kept very good notes. So if the transcript
Well, that in itself is good if we can get those notes. Are they going to give us the notes?
Yeah, we have people that took very, very good notes and are doing very long transcripts of the whole case. And that's forthcoming. That's coming in the future here in a little bit. Well, that's one of the jobs that we have to do here in the next week or two. We need to collect that stuff. And I don't know if people know how to get that stuff. I mean, look at I would even contact Mumford, the attorney that they tased on the floor, and ask him to get it, because he's the guy that led. The Patriots to go there, and he encouraged them. I think he forced her to say. I think he was very good. I think he forced her to say that 27 times because he knew which way they were going to testify. And so I think he's an ally. You know what I mean? When did they ever tase an attorney in a federal court? Never. It's never happened. Ever. Ever. And all he did was ask the marshals, well, let me see your paperwork. Let me see your charging orders. If you're not going to release this man and you say that you got a warrant, which they don't. They don't have a signed warrant. They don't have affidavit. He knows.
You know, we need to do another habeas corpus on this. Let's see, Robert. Robert, are you here? Can we get another next friend to write up a paper for what took place here? And let's do another habeas corpus.
I'll make some calls in the morning.
Okay, let's try to do that, because I'd like to put that, you know, right up front when we're dealing with the habeas corpus is maybe in about 2 or 3 weeks when we're ready to start filing those papers and go after these judges, these chief judges that were given the job of overseeing that these people get their due process of law, and they failed. And we need we're going to go after the clerks also. So there'll be about 30 or 40 judges and 30 or 40 clerks. We're going to go at it very specifically. We want to know. But first, we're going to, you know, see about, we'll give them opportunity to tell us why they acted and why they're doing what they're doing. And then we'll move from there, and then we'll consider indictments. So, I'd like to put this one right up front.
I think it's smart to pursue the ones that blatantly did it in public like she did. I mean, look at. She's low-hanging fruit as far as I'm concerned.
Where are they, by the way? Are they still in Oregon, or did they send them
No,
down
no,
to
they
Nevada?
Shipped them out as soon as they're in Nevada.
So they're in Nevada?
Yeah,
okay, that's where
what's happening now is my last notice was that the Bundys are still in Seattle.
Okay, so let's discover who's holding these people, and so who we have to address.
It's the marshals.
We need to know.
The marshals are holding them.
Well, the marshals are holding them, but that judge permitted this to happen in her courtroom, so she's the one we have to address as far as
the judge
is concerned. We have to address also the prosecutor who should have corrected this problem in the court. We have to address those marshals or one or two or whatever it is. We've got to get the names of these people. We have to address them in this situation. And are they being held in a federal prison or are they being held in the county jail now?
It's a federal high security facility by the airport in Seattle.
Okay. All right, so the marshals, we need to know by what authority. We need to know the very the special the appointed marshal, okay? We need to get that individual, whoever that is. Which I understand there's only 60 of them throughout the United States. Let me think about this. Yeah, 60 of them. Some of these marshals cover more than one district because, I guess population-wise. So, of course, they have, deputy marshals that they bring together and hire to work with them. But anyway, we need to find out whoever it is.
In Portland.
Well, we have to know whoever the appointed one, whoever the president appointed in that district, that marshal, and then any other marshal that's connected. But even if we don't get the other marshals, that's not that important. We've got to get the guy that's in charge. We always go after the person in charge. That's what we got to do because they're the responsible ones.
Well, on Wednesday now, just for information, we should have the decision on whether or not they're going to proceed with the trial of the rest of the Oregon protesters, the Patriots. They have until Wednesday to make that decision.
Okay. All right, well,
it's either dismiss or proceed with trial.
All right, well, look, this case is already, in my mind, concluded to the fact that nothing went wrong up there, so I don't see how they can possibly even consider it. But, of course, they'll do whatever they want to do. But there is enough political pressure, and I think if we can get the judicial pressure down, we'll prevent that from happening. Wednesday is only 2 days away, so I don't see that happening for us to get anything into the courts that quick. Again,
no.
We need these people out there to start cooperating with us so that we can do something.
We just got that word. It first came out yesterday that it was going to be a status hearing on one of the defendants. And then first thing this morning it was changed to no, it's just going to be a decision made on whether or not to have another trial.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody knew ahead of time.
Unbelievable.
They don't know. They don't know what they're doing. How can they have a trial on conspiracy to impede a federal officer, whatever the charge was, when the so-called ringleaders just got turned loose by a jury because they failed to prove conspiracy on that particular subject. Never mind anything else that was done, because Anna Proud made sure that nothing. You see, when she says she didn't want the Constitution, the other thing is she only wanted one fact in there. She was very statutory. She didn't want to know.
We also need to get more detail on jurist number 11, who was working for the federal agency. We need to know who that person is. And you know what? If it's the BLM, then we need to go to the head of the BLM. They're involved. They're responsible. If it's the FBI, then we're going to go to the head of the FBI, special agent in charge. If it has something to do, I doubt it's the marshal. So, but we need
number
to discover
11,
exactly. Yep.
Number 11 had worked for the BLM.
BLM. That's what I heard, the BLM. So that's who we got to go after. We need to get that person, even if we have to call him John Doe. Okay, we'll get it to the court. The court will be responsible to get it to John Doe. But there it is, conspiracy right there. And what did they do with this person?
Does
anybody know? I mean, they threw him off. Yeah?
they knew he worked for the BLM. He said it was 20 years ago. I don't think it'll bother me. So he went in like that. But then he opened his mouth and said that he was biased against these guys. And the judge did her own little investigations. Did you say you're biased? Yeah, but I didn't mean it. Okay, my investigation's done. Go back. Well, if it wasn't for the attorneys really putting pressure, I don't think that she would have replaced him, because I do believe that they left him there for a hung jury just in case they couldn't get a unanimous decision. He was going to be
holdout.
And
by the way, there is no such thing as a hung jury.
Well, that's what they want, so they can redo the trial. That's what they do today. Oh, a hung jury, so they get another whap at it. I mean, that's the way they run their court.
There was a jury trial up here in Hudson Valley recently, and I just heard the decision came in. It took the jury 10 days of deliberating. 10 days they were deliberating. And that's the way to do it. They stay there until they come out with an answer. If they come out and say, well, we just can't do anything, well, then you're coming out and saying, well, we all agree he's got to walk, you know? They got to come with an answer. That's their duty. But go ahead, Gerard.
I lost my train of thought. My point is that, you know, if they want to open the trial, you know, continue the trial on the lesser players, hoping to change tactics. Look, we're not going to go any away. We're only going to be there more now, not less. We're going to have more influence in this new trial. They got to be crazy to try it. It's ridiculous. It's like suicide for them, you know? The other thing is look, they keep locking up these Patriots. Joe, 70-something-year-old guy, you know what I mean? Never heard a flea in his life, right? And they got him in these maximum security prisons. They got them in a... because
they're digging a hole.
Well, he's in the hole right now.
Right.
Yeah, and he's in there for digging a hole.
Yeah, well, they threw him into the hole because he argued with them.
Wow, how can they do that? Yeah, we got to get on that case. We got to get paperwork on this guy before he dies.
They went through his legal papers without his presence. And he just complained about the fact that they, they did this, and so they threw him in isolation.
But nevertheless, they got him in maximum security prisons, and they're not letting him out. And they're saying that they're dangerous. They have nothing to base that on. However, they have a fear, or they have a fantasy, or they have an illusion or delusion, or at least they want us to think they do, and they want the people to, that these Patriots have the ear of the militias, and they're going to come break them out. And they got everybody believing that there's going to be this civil war started over these guys using that bad word, the M word, the militia. Well, there's no militia coming to break anybody out. And if it gets to the point that the militia is breaking them out, that means that they broke the law so bad that somebody called the militia out, the sheriff, the people, whatever. There was a legal process. There's no terrorist militia groups coming that I know of, unless these guys know about some active rogue militias that we don't know about. And, I mean, if that's the case, they still got to let these guys out, and they got to take care of those guys. There's no reason to hold these guys. They're praying that somebody tries to break them out. That's what they want. That's what they trained for, and it's not happening. And they got all them toys sitting there all shined up, and they're bored, and they want to use them. And that's what this is about. You know, they want to vilify the people, and they want to piss everybody off so much that somebody does something stupid and goes and breaks them out. Well, let me tell you what. If the militia's going to come and break them out, it ain't going to happen the way they think. It's going to happen with a couple of sheriffs or six or seven sheriffs, maybe a few federal judges. We're going to come in as the people in force with authority. And that's how the militia will come in. It will come in to back up the people serving the paper, the habeas corpus, to get them out. And you're damn right the militia's coming to break them out. We the people are coming to break them out. So, you know, you can put away your bunker bus bombs. And, you know, unless you want to blow the court up that Anna Brown's sitting in, because that's where we'll be. We won't be in the field shooting at you. We're going to be in the court. We're going to shoot at you over the bar with our words. and see how you like it in front of the people. And we're going to make sure there's television cameras there. That's how this thing is going down. You want to know about the revolution? There's the picture I'm painting in your head. That's the revolution, and we're bringing it. That's the way we're bringing it. In the court, legal, lawful, in words. And nothing hurts more than words. Some people rather take a bullet, apparently, than words.
Hello, am I muted? Hello, am I on?
Yep, go right ahead.
Yes, Lindsay is on here, and she desperately wants to talk about Joe in the prison situation. If you hear me, Lindsay,
does she want to discuss it on live right now, or does she want to have a private meeting?
Yeah, it's live right now.
I just told her to call.
Right. Hi, okay, John. Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yep, go right ahead.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Long time no talk. I've been busy. So with Joe Robertson, it's life or death right now. And I'm serious about that. I know you guys probably have a few updates if you're on Facebook and you followed all the updates I've been doing, but basically he passed out in his counselor's office last Wednesday. They took him to medical. They did not give him medicine. They did not do any blood work. They hooked him up to an EKG, and when I say they, it was a medical manager, not a doctor. They didn't shave the hair on his chest, so the EKG didn't read properly. Joe could feel and hear his heart not working properly. They put him in a wheelchair, took him to the flight of stairs, gave him a cane, and made him walk down 3 flights of stairs down to his cell. The next day, he had a box of clearly marked legal mail. One document was a privacy form for Senator Cory Gardner's office, who has been helping Ollie and myself and wanting to help Joe directly. And the other paperwork was very important to relieve his current public defender. And they took that box away from him. He asked to be present, and they denied him that. So he went back to pick up that box, and we're assuming it's when he went to go pick it up. And he had an argument and disagreement with his counselor, Breezy. And she or someone authorized to throw him in solitary confinement for 3 to 4 weeks. On Veterans Day, they decided to, Miss Breezy went and got him and said, since it's Veterans Day, I'm going to let you out early. She is his counselor. And all we know of her is her first initial is L and the last name's Breese.
Well, you know, we would love to do something. We've been watching and learning of these things and hearing the stories, but our hands are tied. We can't do anything without documentation. You know, the grand jury can't just go in and make an indictment and have no evidence. So we need affidavits. Affidavits is the most powerful evidence you can get, because they have to rebut them, and they never, ever, ever, ever will. And that's the power and the authority that we can use in the courts. So we need affidavits. Even if it's just one good affidavit, but if we can get 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 or more affidavits, the more affidavits, the better it is. Any kind of a document that can be certified, you know, someone can swear that this is a true document and accurate and so on and so forth, and do an affidavit on that document if it's something that we can use. But that's the only way the grand jury can act and then start to put the evidence together so that we can bring it into the court. We're opening a court of record within the next week or two on the federal level here in New York, going out after all of these individuals that are subverting our Constitution and subverting, you know, the high treason against we the people. And so we've done over 30 habeas corpuses. I don't think you were on. We were talking a little early. You might want to go back and listen to the tape for the first hour, because we've been talking about a lot of these things. But, you know, we're going to take these habeas corpuses that were not acted upon. We only had a couple that were acted upon, but we got about 30 or so that have not been. And we're going to bring these judges and the clerks into the court here in Albany. They'll be able to answer by paper. And if we decide to indict, we'll indict with inside this particular case, and we'll set up trial juries inside this, right underneath this trial, this index number that we're pulling out here in New York. And we do want to do something for the case out there in Oregon. We want to go after these murderers of Lavoie Finnegan. We want to go out after these people in Montana. We have written a few papers on this for Mr. Robinson on this, but we have been unable to do a habeas corpus for him because we don't have anybody who is writing the paper. This would be a next friend for him. So anybody, any paperwork you can get for us, any document that is a sworn affidavit, that's what we need. We can act.
I have a very long affidavit, 90% done. Every day something new is getting added to it. But after the phone call today and what happened with him medically passing out and fearing for his life, I can get that going.
Well, maybe you can get what
done.
You got, and you can always add. You know, you can do an addition, addendum to the affidavit.
Okay.
Yeah.
We do have a recorded phone call of Joe stating all this. I have a record audio.
That's perfect. That's perfect. And you will take that. We'll get it transcribed, and then we'll get, if you can use that as a next friend. And you, because you see, you're verifying the fact that it's his voice. You got it from him, or however you got it, and you do a verification on that with the transcript. These are the words. Now that becomes his words. That's an affidavit through a next friend, which is perfectly legal. So that's what we need to do. In order to do anything out there, we need these affidavits, as many as possible. We also would love to get, I understand some people have some of the transcripts or even some of the, I don't know if anyone ever got the audio for what took place out there in Oregon with Judge Brown. Now, we understand that Judge Brown has at least 30 different occasions, I don't know if that's true or false, maybe more, maybe less, has refused the Constitution in her court. I mean, if we can get those transcripts and lay it out and put this into, write the transcripts themselves is a verification. That's the transcripts of the court. That's a document that could be used in a court of law. We can show how she has violated this person's unalienable rights. Also the fact that that she refused the reading of the Bible, which is the common law. It's the law of the land. That's where our law comes from. It's natural law. All these things, as many as possible. Anybody who is abused out there in any way, maybe they've been pulled over on a traffic stop and their face is put into the cement, or their doors were broken down and they were dragged away for jail for a couple of days, or whatever the case may be. All of this abuse, we need to get as much information, but it's all got to be in documents that are verified. In other words, sworn affidavits. So that's what we need. And so we got a lot of things going. We also are working, to try to work with the people working with Trump, with his group, and we're trying to make a connection right now with them. We do have a connection through another individual, but now we're trying to get a direct connection and work with him to hopefully get the marshals. For him to give an order to the marshals to start obeying the law and applying the Constitution. And then we can lay that out to the marshals and give them orders to the courts. This is how we got to do it. And I'm sure there are other people doing things too, and they should do whatever they got to do or can do or they understand.
Yeah, I have a remark on that, a question for Lindsay. In the meantime, I mean, we need those affidavits ASAP. But is there somebody that the people should be calling now? Because if this is life and death, Joe doesn't have time to wait for paper. So I know you got a congressman involved. I mean, there needs to be phone calls going out there, Lindsay.
We've had a national call campaign for about a week and a half, 2 weeks now since we got that frightening phone call from him.
You get that affidavit to me. The moment you get that affidavit, the day after that, we'll have a habeas corpus going out there. If you got it to me tomorrow, we'll have a habeas corpus going out Wednesday.
Okay, and then if I need to just keep adding to it, do another affidavit.
You can do addendums. That's right. You could do another affidavit.
Okay.
And you can make a note that this is, more information, that you're extending the information to this affidavit. We'll add it to it. Absolutely.
Okay, and can I just ask what exactly what type of habeas corpus and what that can do for him?
Well, a habeas corpus is to bring the individual, bring the his accusers, and they have to rebut everything in that affidavit. They also have to answer certain questions. They got to also bring up their proof of what law he broke and why he's in jail. They also are going to have to show proof on why they haven't let him out on his own recognizance while he's waiting for an appeal. And we should also go after his lawyer, because we understand that he refused to do the appeal, and we did the appeal for him, but we understand the day after they got the appeal that we sent in that he also filed one, so they're acting under that one, but we're not hearing anything about that, so I don't know, even know if they're pursuing the appeal or what's really going on there. We need to push these things. This man, there is absolutely no reason he should be in jail at this moment, because he's proven himself to be a person of integrity. He showed up for court. He showed up for the sentencing. He proved that he would be there, and there is no evidence to prove that he might run. Just because they think he might run because that's what they would do, or whatever the case may be, is totally irrelevant. You know, they have to have proof that there's a strong likelihood that this individual is going to run. But if they don't have that, they got to let them loose. That's the law. And we made that clear in our paperwork.
Yeah, what they did is, so Donahoe did file the appeal, and then the denial for his release, they literally wrote in there, and I have copies of it, that he associates and has Malheur Refuge people as supporters.
Yeah, get that paper to us, too, because we'll use that.
And they were found not guilty, so.
Right.
If you could, yeah, that's very interesting.
He's got not guilty people as supporters. My goodness gracious.
Right.
You know, what we do need also is names of people. Like, if you know these people, and if you can get us their addresses, because we're going to go after them and bring them into this court case. And we need to shake their tree, so to speak. You know, rattle their cage. Yes.
John, you need to modify that habeas corpus about denying him medical care. We might be filing papers to get him a medical furlough and get him out for a medical checkup. We're in the process now of getting a release form from the VA. Sent the forms for him to sign for a release form for his medical records.
Well, if we have this information inside the affidavit, or someone gives us a list of different things that need to be concerned about, we already know that he's got illness and that they're not taking proper care. And if that stuff is inside the affidavit, you know, that he's been refused care, or he didn't get his medication and whatever, that kind of thing. You see, that will go after them also, and we'll let them know that if this man dies, we're going after you for murder. Because as far as we're concerned, you know, this is a conspiracy to keep this man in jail. You know he's ill. You know he's elderly. You know that he could die in prison. And if he dies in prison, someone's going to be held responsible. We need to get that onto the record now and put the fear of the people and the law on these people. Go ahead.
Yes, Lindsay, put those facts in the affidavit and also list the names of the counselor, all four of them involved.
And the addresses, if you can get the addresses, you know, we need some place to send it to. So.
It's just the prison's address, but yeah, I have all that.
Yeah.
We've documented this very well on purpose, because we haven't been able to get on his visitor list. And
get us as much documentation as you can. You should talk with the contacts we have out there, which is Ollie and Robert. And then at some point, Jan should be involved to try to pull this all together. And then the other rest of us, you know, Gerard and myself and others will get involved and then try to really bring this together in a way that we can comprehend exactly what's going on, what's happening, and where they're going with this. But we need to get a habeas corpus out right away. We can get it out in 24 hours after we get the document. You know,
he also needs to go to the doctor in the hospital of. It would be nice if it would be of the grand jury's choice, but of his choice.
He needs to get out of jail and go to his own doctor.
Right.
That's
we don't want some bullcrap thing that they set up themselves. You know what I mean? He needs an independent guy there. Okay. I just wanted to mention that.
We also need to know very specifically, possibly in an affidavit form, but very specifically on what exactly he did, okay? I mean, we know we went out there and dug a hole, and but we need to know the story about that in a detail. And we've got to use that also within this habeas corpus to make this point. But right now is a good time to write a habeas corpus because we've got the court case going, and if they don't respond properly, we're going to hold them in contempt of court and require, and we'll bring them right into this court case we open, require them to give an accounting on their actions. And they're going to have to answer.
John, there's a website that has all that detail on it. I'm sorry, Lindsay, I didn't mean to step on you. I did see a website that absolutely explains every point of the Clean Water Act that they claim he violated. It's so ridiculous. It's impossible that those things that he said that went that they claim went down to this waterway 100 miles away was impossible. They have no proof. Anyway, I don't. There
can you get
is,
that link? Throw that link into my Skype tonight or tomorrow.
I don't. I was on. I saw it. I have to go hunt for it unless somebody knows where it is. I came across it, and I get thousands of emails, and I happen to click on it, and I think I saved it, but I'll have to go look. But if anybody knows where it is, it was a very nicely written out, concise timeline, and the guy explained everything about it, and I can't for the life of me remember what that article was. But go ahead, Lindsay. I didn't mean to step on you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. Me and Ollie also did a report with the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, and they're supposed to be mailing that to me. I should get it today or tomorrow. Would that also be something to include?
Oh, yeah. Everything and anything. Look, anything you get from anyone that's talking about this that can give us insight, even if it's not an affidavit form, but enough information to give us insight that we can act upon, okay, because to some degree we can act on hearsay. We can't do a habeas corpus on hearsay. We have to have affidavits for that. But we can do some hearsay because, you know, if we just think that there's a crime, then we can say, hey, let's indict them. And that's that. And then now they have to deal with it in court. And then, of course, we go out, you know, that's when others will go out and start digging up more information in order to make this case. But we don't want to waste anyone's time. We know in this case, you know, that there's an injustice here, clearly, and this individual is being injured, and other people are being injured. His wife is being injured. They stand a risk, I understand, of losing their home and everything over this thing. And someone's got to pay for this. Restitution has to be applied here. And they're going to have to fix this as best they can. And some people need to go to jail on this.
Yeah. They took away his VA benefits and his Social Security, and his wife's living off of donations right now.
You see, that's we need to know that. That's more that we need to know. Anything, we just need to know.
Okay.
So there's nothing that you can think that should you give it to us, give it to us. If we can't use it, we won't use it. It's not going to hurt, you know. But I can't think of anything that we wouldn't be able to use in some way, even in just giving us a better understanding by having more insight. That in itself is important, to be able to write better because we have more insight.
I have that information on that article. This is Rhonda from Washington.
Yeah, go right ahead, Rhonda.
It's Redoubt News Montana.
Can you
and
spell that?
And the heading is Redoubt, Redoubt, News, Montana. We must be kept safe from Joe Robertson. It outlines, it's by Jason Van Tatenhove.
RedoubtNewsMontana.com or something?
Well, it comes up montana.redoubtnews.com.
Okay.
It's an article done July 15th of 16, originally published through the Oath Keepers org.
Redoubt News has done probably 20.
That to me?
They've done 20 articles for Joe. So Redoubt News, Sherry Duvall, she's done like 20 articles on Joe.
It's good stuff, John. I read it. It's really documented very well. It's everything that we need as far as documentation of what they did in the charges. I think it's great. And that's it. Thank you, Ron.
Sherry's on board with us.
Yeah, I remembered.
Yeah. Okay. You're welcome.
All right. Yeah, I'm on the website now, so I'm going to put it in my notes here, and we'll start using some of this information.
Yeah, there's a tag at the bottom that says Joe Robertson. If you click on that, it'll bring up all the articles for you.
Yep, that's where I'm at right now. Okay, so we'll do that. All right, anything else? Otherwise, we're going to get back onto our regular programming. And again, you know, if you want to talk with us at any time, go through Robert or and get to Jan, because Jan can always find us. If we're hard to get sometimes, myself and Gerard, but Jan can usually find us if it's necessary.
She's got Ollie here right there. Ollie's right there in the neighborhood.
Ollie,
so.
Me and Ollie are buddies. We hang out all the time.
Well, you're in trouble then. That's all I got to say.
Me and Lindsay are close. We are spiritual close. We are very, very close. In fact, we start talking. We know what each other's going to say before they say it. We're that close.
Yeah, those Lindsay and Ollie are a real pair to draw to, I'll tell you.
Okay, if there's nothing else, we're going to get back to our regular programming, okay?
Thank you all very much. God bless.
Thank you. Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Thank you for that station break.
Thanks, guys. Okay. I'm going muted.
Okay, thanks, Ollie. All right, let's see. Jen, do we have any questions?
Yes, I have three tonight.
Okay.
The first one says, how can we avoid falling back onto the total reliance on a religious belief system as the fundamental backbone of a system of government and remain in honor with life, expressly reserving all rights, including but not limited to the right to take a meaningful oath of citizenship, and to uphold the laws of the United States with the correct sentence structure?
Okay, so basically they're concerned with destructive religion tainting and violating the process again. Is that what they're concerned with?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand that.
Yeah, they don't want to be totally reliant on a religious belief system.
Well, absolutely. Let's look at this. First of all, you know, a lot of churches out there, they're astray. Anything else but really having a relationship with God. You know, the enemy has also, secured or, you know, infiltrated religion as much as they've infiltrated anything else. All of the inhumanities in the name of God has nothing to do with God's children. God's children would be nothing involved with that. Those are people who have infiltrated, taken over a particular religious structure for the for the purpose of taking power, and just doing evil things, bringing glory to themselves and not to our Creator. But when it comes to common law is really God is very clear on this. He put his laws into our minds and into our hearts. We the people know right from wrong. It's innate. God said very clearly, He wrote it into our hearts and into our minds. You know, you're not to kill anybody, you're not to murder, you know, you're not to steal from people, and so on. And the people know, because we live in the same world, we know when someone's been violated that restitution is required, and it becomes that simple. The key thing about this with God is this. We have unalienable rights. They come from our Maker, and it's very clear. We have complete liberty. As long as we don't affect someone else's rights in any way, we don't injure anyone, we have the right to do whatever we want. Now, for instance, if someone wanted to smoke marijuana or they want to put a needle into their arm because they want to get high, they have a right to do that. Not that it's right to do, but no one should get in the way of that. They shouldn't do it in public because then, you know, they could be corrupting the morals of a minor to begin with. So those kind of things shouldn't be done in public. But in the privacy of their own home or whatever they're doing, they have every right to do those things. We have a duty maybe to, if we have the opportunity and we're their neighbors, to maybe talk to them about this. They're hurting their lives. They're destroying their own, their health or whatever. But again, our behavior is between us and God, and it's that clear. But when it comes to law, comes into the getting into the courtroom, the key thing is three things: coming in with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy. Looking at the facts. A court case is all about the facts. So you come in with the facts, and the jury looks at the facts. You get 12 people looking at these facts, and believe me, they'll come up and realize what's going on. A jury without all the BS, without all of this stuff, you know, the twists in law that this system that these people have created, which really just puts a lot of smoke out there and prevents people from seeing the facts. We just need to give the people the facts, and the people will make a righteous decision. I don't see in any way how this can be hijacked by a religious movement or, you know, some denomination of some kind or some kind of religious structure, because nothing like that should be connected to it. It's a matter of right and wrong. And as far as the law is concerned, first of all, nobody can make a law to require us to behave in a certain way. You know, you can't make a law, you know, just getting into some of the things that people all the time happen. You know, they make it illegal for you to have a weapon without a permit, or they make it illegal for you to drive without a car. That's a behavior that has nothing to do with them. They shouldn't be getting involved in that. People who have been, you know, go to jail because they were had possession of something that the government thinks that we shouldn't have. That's our business. It's not their business. So it's very simple, really. I don't see how religion can hijack these things. I mean, as long as we just stay on principles. We are the king's bench. As a grand jury, we're the king's bench. The king is God. It's natural law, which is running under principles, maxims. A maxim is something that's undeniable. You know, it's a truth on its face. It can't be denied. for instance, the idea that water can't run uphill, that's a fact. It can't be denied. That ultimately is a maxim, you know. We're created in the image of God. The fact that we all have the same rights. Nobody has more rights than another person. We all have the same unalienable rights. You can't give up your rights. You can't sell them. They can't be taken away from you. You know, these are all maxims and principles. So religion can't really hide it.
I think they're talking about somebody that doesn't accept that we have principles from any God. And the answer is this nation was founded on a Magna Carta idea, and it was founded on the laws of nature and nature's God. And you can't get away from that. Now, if you got some other God, we don't say that you can't believe that. But this nation was founded on that principle. And whether you like it or not, actually, you're getting the benefit of it. Look, there's lots of different religion. That's not a denomination thing. That's a generalized thing. But it's focused enough that we assume that everybody knows who that God is, and we know it is the God of Abraham. And if you don't like that, then that's too bad, because that's what it's founded under.
Maybe someone is ignorant in some way or fashion. They don't know nothing about the God of the Bible, but they understand that there's a creator. They know that the creator is right. That's how the Declaration
is. That's right. But the thing is,
that's good enough.
Look, we should not have a communist party running in the United States. That's too tolerant. When you have a group who has a manifesto that is to take over a Republican form of government and usurp it with something that equates the leaders as God, we're stupid. That's like saying we're going to allow so many milligrams of arsenic every day in our diet. There's no good can come out of that.
Well, it's subversion, just like the teaching of the Bible.
That's right. So even Sharia law, whatever they want to do amongst themselves is fine. But the minute that they're doing things that violate those things that we abhor and that we believe that every human creation has a right to, every child, every woman, every person, you're not going to take them out in the street and stone them, I'm sorry. You know what I mean? Because they violated some religious belief of yours or whatever. That's where we draw the line. They can have their Sharia law. They can do whatever they want to do. They can sanction each other. They can shun people. They can do whatever they want. But they can't violate. When it gets down to the laws of nature, that's where you were going, John, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it's their religion to smash babies' heads and let blood, we're going to allow that? I mean, where do you stop? I mean, the laws of nature, God, was a good place to start, because you got the Ten Commandments that have been around for ages and ages and ages. We're going to argue about that? We're going to look at I mean, we had the Code of Hammurabi there, wasn't it? Wasn't it an eye for an eye, a tooth for tooth type thing? Remember?
Mm-hmm. But, well, you know, look at let's get back to the essence of the Bible itself. The essence of the Bible, God speaks of laws and speaks of statutes. Okay. You know, for myself, having a relationship with Christ and believing myself to be a child of God, I look to God as a father and me as a son to my father. And from that relationship, I am obligated, me, because I put myself under that obligation because I want to do the right thing, I'm obligated to obey the statutes of God, okay? All men are obligated to obey the law of God. The law of God is thou shalt not kill. You know, you can't injure your another person. You take a man's ox, you got to give him back three. You got to restore him back three or four oxes. Okay, that's restitution. Those are the laws of God. That, you know, you steal, you have to fix the person. You injure, you have to fix the person. Okay, but as far as, for instance, being required to keep the Sabbath day holy, that's a statute. For me, I have to obey that. Someone else, you know, the laws, the, you know, the court system cannot go through that process to apply the statutes of God. And therein is the difference. And it's very simple. There's not much to law. There's two principles, you know. In order for there to be a crime, there must be an injured party. So if there's an injured party, people look at that. They say, yeah, that person's injured. It's very clear. Someone's been injured or they wouldn't, okay? And the second principle is for every injury, there must be a remedy, okay? You can't say, well, okay, we're going to put this person in jail or you're going to do this, that, or the other thing, and then you ignore the injured party. No, first and foremost, how are you going to restore that injured party? And if it's a violent crime, what are you going to do to prevent this individual from hurting someone else? And there's remedies for all of that. And we have to sit down and think it out. It's that simple. I see no way that that religion can hijack our judicial process. It just can't happen, at least not the from the Bible. The Bible in itself won't permit it. You know, we can't apply our misbehavior. Our behavior is our business. As long as I don't injure another person, it's my business. You can't make a law against that. You can't make a law because I do something that you think is immoral. And it's that simple. And we're all responsible to answer to God at the end anyway, concerning our morality, our relationship with each other. And, you know, we look to people, and God says that, you know, we're created in his image. So when we violate another human being, we're violating God, whether people understand that or not. But that's something you're going to answer ultimately at the end of your life. That's between you and your maker. So I don't see any way for violation. But anyway, what's another question?
Hello, John?
Yeah?
John?
Yes?
It's Mary Carmel.
How you doing, Mary?
Good. How are you guys doing? I just wanted to jump
Good.
In really quick. Well, first of all, I think we should all be saying a lot of prayers. We really dodged a bullet this week with Hillary Clinton. And I think we really, really need to be saying a lot of prayers between now and the inauguration because, you know, Trump's in a lot of danger.
Amen.
A lot of people.
Well, one of the things we talked a little bit about this at the beginning of our program, and we have to get behind Trump. We have to support
yes.
him. And the more and more people and more different groups of people that can get behind him, and we all need to learn to work together, whatever it is that we're doing from the liberty perspectives, we're doing the grand jury, and we're also doing the political process and all this stuff. Other people are doing Oath Keeper stuff or whatever, but we all got to get behind. If the numbers get behind and we keep get behind Trump, it makes it harder for them to do something evil to him. And I'm sure he's aware. He knows. He's not dumb.
Yes, and I've been in contact, actually, with his team because I did a lot of supporting for him through the campaign. I've been indirectly involved with his team as well. And they know we're out here. Yeah, they do. The other thing I just wanted to mention to you is that I have burnt out two batteries in my computer here, which I need to bring it over to I want to make sure it's not my computer. But so I have 75% through the civics course, and I had done the introduction on the constitutional course. But I was able to do it out of my not an iPad, my iPhone. I have a big one, and I was able to carry on the questions. But evidently, it doesn't carry Flash anymore, Apple. So So I just want to let you know that people with that can get online with their iPhones and stuff, for some reason we can't answer the questions.
Well, you know what? You want to bring that to you go up there for help, and Catherine, I believe, is still dealing with that. And if necessary, she can get a hold. This sounds like a technical problem that we'll have to get a tech guy on to call. And so if you give a call to Jan will get a hold of Carl. I don't know if Carl's on the call tonight. If you are, Carl, maybe let us know. But Carl can help you with, and let you know whether we're compatible there. We try to be compatible with everything possible, of course.
Right. No, I was doing the questions out of my phone before, but Apple dropped Flash Player, so there's got to be something else in place. And I might be able to call Apple, too, and say what's going on as well. I'll give them a call, too.
Yeah.
Before you go on,
let me just finish up with the questions that are coming through. I'll finish up with you. Then I want to move over to Brent, but hang on one second, Mary. Let's see, Jen, any other questions?
Yes, there's two more. Would NLA support a state's legislature attempting to secede? What scenarios would NLA deem this a viable strategy in order to resist the oppressive and out-of-control Leviathan Big Brother government we have?
Yeah, this isn't the time for seceding. I don't know what state would consider it at this point. The problem has to be done collectively, because the violation on whatever state this is that might consider seceding is the same violation to all the other states. And so, matter of fact, our court papers that we're going to be writing, because we're writing to the governors, the governors will be responsible for bringing our message to their legislators. But nevertheless, we're going to be dealing with some of the problems. I mean, goodness, the states have no say in the federal government, because they took away, the senators, so that they have no say in their government. Let me see how it's put in the Constitution. This would be, I think it's Article 7. So Article 7? Yeah, I think it is. Hold on. The convention, witness thereof. I thought it was in 7. Do you know where it's at, Gerard? You know what I'm talking about? I'm trying to read.
That where they say no state shall be deprived of.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the word they use. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to think of.
Yeah, of their suffrage or something like that.
Yes, of equal suffrage.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I'm not.
My oath, affirmation. I'm looking at it right now. I don't know why I can't see it. It should be right here. Ratification. This is ratification. Authority states. Yeah, it should be in 7. Is it convention unanimous? Okay. Well, anyway, they have to have the ability to have a say in the federal government, and they get that through their senators. And the 17th Amendment took that away from them. And the Constitution itself forbids any kind of a law or any kind of a change of the structure of our government in that way. If they don't have, I think it's called equal suffrage. Is that what it is?
I think that was the term they used.
I don't know why I can't find it. Ratifications between the states ratifying. I'm not seeing it here. You know what? I'll just in the middle of things bring it up, and I'll read it.
Yeah, when they talk about the senators and how many senators there should be in that, I think it was in there and how they're picked. Anyway.
Well, I'm pretty sure it was Article 7. I don't know why I can't find it here. So ratifying, done in the convention, 17th day, no. Yeah, I don't know why I'm not seeing it. Because Article 6 gets into the law of the land, judicial offices, no religious qualifications. Right, I'll find it later. Let's get back to the programming. I'll respond.
Okay, John, I just wanted to pop in and say that I'm going to go. I know you have the program to go on, but really quickly, on the Second Amendment, when President-elect Trump was asked about the Second Amendment, and they asked him to elaborate, that he was being vague. He had a really, he answered it right. He said no. He said the Second Amendment, he said, it's not for the government to give.
Right.
He said, well, we do know
that Trump has some failings in his understanding of the Constitution, or some of his ideas violates the Constitution. And we're going to try to discover all as much as we can and make it clear to him and try to educate him to understand. Because, look, if he wants to really, bring America back and make America great again, then we have to reinstate the Constitution. And if we're going to reinstate the Constitution, he needs to understand that and be an example to the next president after him, on how
right.
he should be.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that he did, I feel the same way, but I was very impressed because he did answer it correctly, because he said no, because it's, we know that is an inherent right.
He got the first question right. Give him a mark there. We're counting.
Yes. Everybody was like, yay. All of us, constitutionalists out here, we were like, yay. He answered that. He said there's nothing to explain. He said because it's not a right for the government to give. He says it's your right, natural right, basically, to paraphrase him. Okay?
Well, that means he has a very good idea, so that means that he'll learn. Whatever he doesn't know, he'll learn easily because it's in his heart, in other words.
Yes. And he might have had some of this stuff early on in life, too. I mean, he went to some military school and some, so he has some good education behind him. So I think he knows more than we think. But so let's think positive, and let's just be thankful, everybody, this week, and just pray for his safety, because things are kind of nasty out there. I'll let you guys go.
Okay, thank you. All right, Jen, what's the last question?
Okay, the last one. This person has a case pending in the circuit courts. Question is, can you discuss the writ of mandamus versus the declaratory judgment? I am wanting to file judicial misconduct complaints as it relates to the officers of the courts. Should they both, a writ of mandamus and declaratory judgment, be filed? And if not, which one is preferred?
Well, when you say declaratory judgment, what do you mean by that? Do you know?
I have no clue. It does not elaborate.
Yeah, I don't know what they're talking about. Look, habeas corpus is a very simple thing. It really is a statutory way of going to get your Fifth Amendment right of due process. It's that simple. And so, really, it's pressing the individuals involved in getting you reincarcerated or held into the court for them to come up and show proof by what authority. There's got to be sworn affidavits or someone come up and swear and a witness against you. That's where it all has to start. And if that can't happen, if they have no witnesses, they have no sworn affidavit, they have no injured party, they got to let you loose. That's the law. And now they don't want to obey that law. And that's the problem. So as far as I don't know what he means by the other thing. What was that called? The other
declaratory judgment.
Okay, I don't know what that means. I mean, a judge makes a judgment all the time, and they shouldn't be doing it. If it's a criminal case, they can't do make a judgment. It's only that's up to the tribunal. I don't know what they're talking about there on that. So, all right, is that it?
Yes, that's all.
Okay. All right, we're running really late. I do want to give Brent some time. Brent, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, we're going to pass things on to Brent. Brent is the author of The Excellence of Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thanks, and thanks for letting me come on a little bit. For now, no man knows everything. If I knew everything, I'd tell God to scoot over and I'd get in the throne with him. But I don't know everything. And Donald Trump, the Donald himself, he knows a lot of things that I don't know, but he doesn't know everything. And because we don't know everything, when a problem is presented to us, we take what we do know and try to see what we do know is applicable to the problem. I recently went to Las Vegas, driving into town, and my eyes aren't as good as they used to be, and I don't see distances like I did, but I saw a building that struck my attention. I'd never noticed it before downtown. Well, not downtown, the old downtown, but where the strip is. I was on the Interstate 15, and I saw this building kind of off by itself, away from all the casinos over on the left-hand side, and it had windows. It was a skyscraper with windows all kind of a golden color, and on the top, I thought it said Trump, and come to find out it did when I got closer. Donald Trump has spent his life building things. And so when somebody said we have an illegal alien problem, the first thing that apparently popped into his head is, what can I build to stop this? And so he said, I'll build a wall. And I believe that he has the wherewithal to build a wall, and now we've learned that Congress appropriated the billions of dollars for it a long time ago, but passed the law and said what they wanted. But, of course, the president, being a separate and equal branch of government of the executive branch, is not bound by any law in our Constitution to do anything Congress tells him to do. He said, I'm not going to do it. And, of course, he didn't even want to talk about it. But the money's there, and Donald has made the commitment to build the wall, and I'm satisfied he's got the connections that would allow that wall to be built. And the money's there, by the way, too. So we all must contribute what we know. And don't think for a minute that Donald Trump is the answer to our problems. He's not. He's an encouragement. Details won't amount to much with him. He's a man that I like to think, and I'm hoping is and seems to be what I like to call right-headed. Right-headed. He has the propensity to recognize what is true, I hope, and then when he sees it, he'll grasp it. When a problem arises, and this is the nature of our common law, it's unknown, its application is unknown until a problem arises where we need application. And I hope that's what happens. I'd like to say a word also at the beginning about cultivation. And we were talking a while ago, and this came up last week also, about religion and cultivation. And I'm bringing up the point of cultivation. A country or a people will cultivate what they deem to be valuable. That's been said by people through the ages. Now, I'm quoting when I say that, but I don't remember how many people I've read that have said it in different ways. One of them is Sir William Ramsay. He said a country or a people will cultivate what they consider to be worthwhile. And when I was at home growing up, we cultivated corn, and we considered it worthwhile because we thought we could get some money for it, not to mention feed it to cattle and hogs, and we did that. But we were very careful when we cultivated it, especially when the plants were young and tender, and we went very slow, and we tried to, before the days of herbicide, get the weeds out of the field. We cultivated it. And we in America, if we're wise, we'll cultivate what's worthwhile. We'll care for it. We'll try to maintain it. We'll teach it, even. And what's worthwhile is what has made America the greatest engine of wealth and prosperity and peace and freedom the world has ever known. You have to ask yourself, as many people have through the ages since the country started, what is it that has caused this to happen? And at bottom, it is the laws of nature, and the laws of nature's God, the laws of nature unwritten in the nature of things in creation that we can observe, unwritten, general and applicable to all men at all times, never changes. And the second volume, the laws of nature's God written in the Bible. That's it. There is no other revelation of our Creator to us. But that is sufficient. It's more than we can comprehend. And he wants us to give attention to it, and our Declaration of 76, of course, acknowledges it, as other writings of those of that day that decided to set up a country. Now, nine of 13 colonies to become states, and did become states, sovereign states, nine of them, nine of them taxed their residents to support the religion of that state at the time of the ratification of our Constitution. And it remained that way in those nine states for a long time. State religion. And the purpose of the First Amendment of the Constitution was to allow the states to do whatever they wanted and for the general government in Washington, D.C. to not interfere in any way. If a state wanted to have state religion, that was their business, and nine of them did. And the First Amendment, for that reason, says that Congress shall make no law respecting a particular establishment of religion. Well, what establishment were they talking about? The establishment of state religion of the nine states. We cannot understand how the First Amendment religion applies to long government in America until we first try to at least wrestle a little bit with the First Amendment. What did it mean when it was written? What did the men then understand? And then we can apply it accurately now. They did understand fundamental things. They did understand that government is impossible without law. Government must rest on law. They knew that. And there can be no law. They knew this also. There can be no law without a lawgiver. A lawgiver. A final arbiter of right and wrong in particular instances. A lawgiver is a final arbiter of right and wrong in particular instances. And both words in the Bible, in the Old Testament, El in the singular, Elohim in the plural, and Theos in the Newer Testament, both all those words in both Testaments translated by the old Anglo-Dane word God. Both of those words meant in the ancient world and ought to mean today, we ought to understand them this way, lawgiver. Final decider, final arbiter of right and wrong for men in particular instances. Where do particular instances arise? They arise in the courts. Justice is only had in the courts where real cases and controversies, as our Constitution puts it, arise. And there can be no law without a lawgiver, and we have traditionally called such a person, and it has to be a person, we've called such a person a God. And that's why Jesus Christ says in the New Testament, when he grappled with the leaders of Judaism, Babylonians' Judaism, the Pharisees, he said, "You explain to me, boys, you explain it to me, how is it that God in the Scriptures says in the Old Testament, ye, speaking of your jurors and judges, ye are gods? How do you explain that?" Well, of course, the explanation is that the word there translated gods is Elohim, little g, men given the task within a limited jurisdiction to decide right and wrong within a limited jurisdiction. And to decide it according to the Old Testament law, to decide it according to the first principles of the standards of God, the first principles the Bible calls the ten general principles, the ten matters, the ten things. We call them the Ten Commandments. And so there can be no government without a lawgiver. And man's response back to a lawgiver, his adherence to his will, his law, his standard, man's adherence to that, his response back, is called religion. Re legere, an old Latin word. Re means back or again, and legere, we get our word ligament from legere, it means a binding, to bind back, to make a lig back, to obey God, to respond back to your lawgiver. Your lawgiver, is he Muhammad? Is he the Pope of Rome? Is the lawgiver the combined will of into one will of the Supreme Court of the United States, so it's okay to murder babies? Is that the lawgiver of some people? I submit to you it is, without question. Is your lawgiver a man like Hitler, an emperor like the Emperor of Japan? That was their lawgiver, and they died for him. No question. Men doing it today. Men are willing to die. They better be willing to say they're willing to die for the dictator of North Korea. He is their God. If you don't believe it, go ask them. They'll tell you. The only public worship permitted in North Korea is worship of the dictator. All of these false lawgivers and all over the world are very much alive, and man is weak. And you see it with the wailing and the crying. I was out last night, and I saw folks marching up and down the street in a little mountain town in the north side of California. They were screaming and crying and wailing and talking about murder of Donald Trump. Wailing because their little Jezebelian goddess, their little demon goddess, they call her Hillary. The woman, the Jezebel, that is so afraid of men, she wants control of all men and all women. And that's what drives a woman like that, is fear of men. And then the men that follow them, fear men. They fall into the same Jezebelian error. It's ugly. And it comes to murder and death for hundreds of thousands, always has and always will. Again, I'm not putting Donald Trump up as the answer. He's not. But if he's right-headed, and God has delegated the governments of men to men, then it takes the combined understanding of him, others around him, and us, as we seek to, and start with yourself, govern yourself. We're talking about government of yourself right now when we're talking about the militia clauses of the United States Constitution. The militia clauses of the U.S. Constitution, there are four of them, four militia clauses. We've been going through this for a while. We're getting close to the end of these presentations, if I'm allowed to keep making them. The militia clauses are the law of our land. How do I know? Because there are four of them found in the text of our Constitution of the United States. And Article 6 of our Constitution says this Constitution and laws made pursuant to it, of course, are the supreme law of the land. Now, it does not say, as some accuse it, that it is the supreme law. No, it says here, it's the supreme law of the land. That's different. There is a greater law. The supreme law of the land is, I lifted from Magna Carta, Chapter 39, and that was their phrase, meaning common law due process. Common law due process, not what is to be done as much as how it is to be done. That's what our Constitution is about. It defines the relationships between parts of government, the branches of government, and the relationship between government and the people. The people being a phrase referring to the militia of the several states. I'm quoting the Constitution, militia of the several states. What are the benefits of the militia? I'd said last time, first, the number one benefit, I'll just name some of them and talk about them briefly. The benefit of the militia of the several states is, and the militia is the people, armed or unarmed, thus the militia, you can't get rid of them. The militia of the several states does away with the temptation to politicians to plan and promote war, to gain the power they desire. Although periodic eruptions of war will occur and do quicken our countrymen to a common conviction and goal, true and ever-present unity among the people of the United States requires a common generation-by-generation experience. A common generation-by-generation experience. And the militia of the several states provides that. It attaches the older generation by experience, common experience, to the present generation, and attaches those two generations to the younger generation who look forward to that rite of passage for young men, when they will be responsible by law to purchase, to obtain a weapon of the military grade their state legislature demands, under pain of penalty, fine if they don't do it, and also to obtain the training of safety and marksmanship the legislature sets forth. But a common experience, old, middle-aged, and younger men will have. It will draw the nation together. That's one of the benefits of the militia of the several states. Our Constitution requires Congress to formally declare war. We talked about that, to take, and by doing so, then Americans have proven in the past, once they declare war, follow due process, and that's the process due for going to war, is to declare war. Congress must declare an enemy. How do you know who you're fighting if they don't define? That's what a declaration of war is all about, to say, this is our enemy. These people are our enemies. This nation or these people. However Congress wants to to define our enemy. And by the way, there can be no treason. Convictions, according to the definition of treason our Constitution gives us, there can be no convictions of treason unless you define the enemy. It's not enough to say, well, these people are our enemies, and the Constitution says to give comfort and aid to our enemies is treason. Well, no. If Congress hasn't said who our enemies is, who are our enemies? Whoever the prosecutor wants to say is our enemies? How do you think that would work? I'll tell you how it would work. Your enemy, our enemy, would then be anyone who would oppose them politically. And the treason clause would be used to crush political opposition in our own country. And that's why Justice Story makes such a strong case and makes much of the idea that our Constitution precisely defines treason, because he says where treason is not precisely defined in the law of a nation, treason will be used to crush political opposition. And that's why, in my humble studied opinion, why we have not declared war since World War II, so that we the people could not get at these scummy, dirty people that work us up to patriotism, create false enemies like terrorism, false enemies like poverty, false enemies, you name it. It's always something. Terrorism. No, our enemy must be people. And to give comfort, how can you give comfort and aid to terrorism? You can't. No, it comes down to people. I had a brother that attended the war college, the Naval War College. And by asking when he got back, this is many years ago, I said, what'd you learn? He said, well, two things, for sure. All other things being equal, numbers always win. Well, that may be true in a military context, but that's not even always true there. And he made that acknowledgement. It's not always true. In a political context, it's just a critical mass. It's not always numbers. Majorities don't always rule. But he said the more important thing that he said he learned is that, and this is proven in the laws of nature through the centuries, you can pay a man $30 a month to die for his country if he believes he's doing the right thing. But you cannot pay a federal agent $50,000 to $100,000 a year to die for his country because he won't do it. That was a fascinating revelation. But he also said that he learned that a war against anything but men is a waste of time, and a war for anything but gaining real estate, dirt, land, is a waste of time. So we have wars in places like Vietnam where they told them they were fighting for an ideal to gain the hearts and minds of men and women. And they never did fight for dirt. If they ever did take any dirt, they did what we've done over in the sand-dominated area of the world. Over in the Arab countries, we take the dirt and we give it all back. We get nothing. They get everything. Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, good many, Saudi Arabia. They get it all back, and our enemies come in and reap the benefits. Enemies? Well, I don't know who our enemies. The people that are against us in that case. But treason is not possible without a declared enemy. That's the point I'm trying to make. Not under our Constitution. Second benefit of the militia, it gives every family a real stake and meaningful responsibility in their local township, their local county, and their local state, and then also, by that, their nation. Young men will look forward to that responsibility, as I'd said a while ago. Older men and women will take a deeper interest in the younger men, and the younger men will take a deeper interest in the older men. In short, the militia gives every man and boy a meaningful part among his kith and kin in his nation, whether older or younger. Third reason the militia, benefit of the militia, it gives us a benefit, if we would but observe it, the four militia clauses and their demands. The militia diminishes need for other police or armed forces, local or national, to act among us. Let me repeat that. The militia of the several states diminishes need for other police or armed forces, local or national, to act among us. Indeed, because the militia includes all able-bodied men, 20 years old and upward, or thereabouts, it will include all arts and skills and creativity to a degree unknown in standing armed forces and police units. The militia would comprise and does comprise. Right now, as we speak, the militia of the several states everywhere in our country comprises medical doctors, clergymen, administrators, technicians, electricians, carpenters, builders, brick and stone masons, iron workers, engineers, boiler makers, pattern makers, hydrologists, heavy equipment operators, mechanics, counselors, experienced laborers, lawyers, teachers, scientists, geologists, that's just the beginning, riflemen, gunsmiths, and I've just barely scratched the surface of all the skills that the militia of the several states can bring to whatever duties the militia of the several states require. And the effectiveness of a standing armed force, says General George Marshall of World War II fame, the effectiveness of a standing armed force lies not in its professional men. Listen to that. Now, we're talking about a professional soldier here. He was the fellow that was senior to Eisenhower and had every right to lead the forces into Europe. But he wasn't chosen to do so because his name wasn't German. The intimidation factor was important, and I don't fault that choice. But Marshall was an experienced professional soldier, and he says the effectiveness of a standing armed force lies not in its professional men, but in its citizen soldiers. And sailors, I don't want to leave those out, they used to be a sailor. Because the restrictions of a martial lifestyle have never habituated their minds and lives, leaving their creative powers less hampered. Professional military men, their creative powers are hampered, without question. I say that with experience. To be habituated to military life is to be habituated to a culture of martial law. To be habituated to a culture of martial law limits a man's habits and thinking. Well, maybe that's necessary in some circumstances, but the militia of the several states does not suffer with that. And I say that on the authority of General George Marshall. And if you want to read more about that particular point of view, one of the best books I ever read, back when I was a young military man, was The American Military Officer by George Marshall, General of the United States Army. The American Military Officer, I recommend it to you. It's not boring reading at all. He just goes through example after example after example in history of men in the armed forces of the United States who nobody thought were worth much anything. But when the duty arose, something in them sparked, and they became the leader above all of the officers and other non-commissioned officers in their unit. That's usually what it amounted to. Because of what they brought, they were non-military professional men, because of what they brought to the desperation of the situation at hand. Well, I'll start into one other section here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about police state culture. I call it police state culture. Sometimes I call it the criminal law industry. The industry that has developed around the federalization, especially, of criminal law. It is an industry, and there are millions of people and millions and billions of dollars at stake. And there are a lot of folk that have a vested interest in keeping it going in full force and growing it. Over the past 175 years, since the time we began neglecting our four militia clauses of our Constitution, Americans have gone from refusing to allow policemen to tote guns to not only allowing them to carry firearms, but in addition, nowadays tolerating mere petty bureaucrats to carry concealed weapons, such as BLM employees. They're armed now. Didn't used to be so, and I remember when it wasn't so, and I remember being on federal land working when it wasn't so. They dealt with us a little more respectfully, I'll say that. They still had that bureaucratic attitude, but they didn't come threatening to shoot people. And I don't know. I'd never. I was in on federal land, BLM land, a long time. I'd never heard of a BLM agent ever being shot at or shot. Now, I knew a lot of people in the mining business that shot their partners. I count four off the top of my head in just a few short years around where I was, but never was a federal agent threatened with a gun. But now they're all armed without reason. They all pack heat, IRS agents and BLM agents, and who knows how many others that I don't know about. I don't have a lot of contact. They're not the kind of people I seek contact with. Consider further, federal prison guards and local police and bailiffs have gone from dressing in pressed shirts and ties to donning commando-style uniforms and gear. Policemen have exchanged their dress shoes and creased dress trousers for the commando's combat boots and bloused fatigues. And nowadays, even rural county court bailiffs look more like they are outfitted for a clandestine assassination raid behind enemy lines than they are to maintain order in a country court. These are badges of something going terribly wrong. And it angers me, and it ought to anger you, and if it does, there's something wrong with you. And the people that engage in this ought to be ashamed of themselves. These folks are our servants. That idea is gone from their minds. We are the enemy. They must suppress us. You're an officer of the court. You just argued a case in court, in federal court. Your client was just acquitted. Well, we're not going to have that. We're going to come inside the courtroom in front of the judge, because the judge apparently is with us, and we're going to tase you three or four times to teach you who's boss. Do you think that that lawyer will ever go back into the courtroom feeling the same way about the integrity of our courts? I wasn't there, but I don't feel the same way. And it wasn't real positive before. I do think that it's good, of course. We have common law courts. The jury was there. Apparently, there were people on the jury that were biased. No, there are always people on the jury that are biased. Who am I kidding? That's part of the human experience. But apparently, the jury worked. And, of course, the behavior of the judge in that case and the things that were said, I heard you talking about a while ago, that just proves and goes to show why we have juries. As Justice Scalia said, if you don't have juries, all you've got standing between the accused and the government is a lone employee of the state. I'm quoting Justice Scalia, a lone employee of the state. He was talking about the judge. Well, these are ill-advised choices, and they foster in government employees, as well as in the eyes of others, a false and downright dangerous view of themselves and their positions, encouraging the lack of restraint on their part, and we see it today, while sending an unnecessary message of hostility toward those who pay and keep them, and they would do well to remember they are kept men. The payback is they got security and great benefits, but they are kept men. It's a privilege to be in their position. If we could bring that attitude back. Well, this is Brent, and that's enough comments for tonight. And thank you again, gentlemen, for letting me say a few words.
Okay, thank you, Brent. We're going to take questions in a minute or two, but I do want to pick back up where we were talking a little earlier concerning the Senate and the right of the state. That was found in Article 5 of the Constitution. For some reason, I thought it was after Article 6. So I was looking in the wrong area. But anyway, it's Article 5, and this is what it says. Now, this is in the body of the Constitution, and it makes all sense in the world, of course. That was the purpose of the creation of the Senate. No state, without its consent, shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Now, that word suffrage means right to vote. So, no state, without its consent, shall be deprived of its equal right to vote in the Senate. This is how the states have their say in our federal government. And when they created the, when the 17th Amendment, which never was ratified anyway, but when the 17th Amendment was claimed to have been ratified and became law, then the right of the state for equal vote of the in the Senate didn't exist anymore. So the 17th Amendment was a direct violation against the Constitution itself. And, you know, look at, the Senate was created for the sole purpose for the state to have its say in the federal government. You know, Congress, as far as our representatives, were created for the sole purpose for we the people to have our say in the federal government. And that's the process. But right now, the states have no say. So the states don't need to leave the union, you know, and try to get out of it. That's the worst thing to do. United we stand and divided we fall. If the states are serious about doing something, what they need to do is fire the two senators that they have on their state, get their own senators, and get their own representation in the Senate, and then other states should be following, and then the states can take back the authority and take control of the this out-of-control federal government as much as we, the people, through the grand juries and through the political process, once we take those two processes back. So that's the key here, and that's what we're going to be talking about in our court case also. We're going to make it clear to these governors that they need to understand that they can take back their authority. They need to go talk to their Congress, you know, work it out with their two houses in their state, and come up with resolutions and get rid of the two senators that are unconstitutionally going out into representing I don't even know who they're representing anymore. They're actually representing special interest groups, large corporations, you know, because certainly they're not representing the people either. The states need to take control of this again. And they don't need a constitutional amendment. They don't need a law. It's already here. It's right here in Article 5. No state, without its consent, shall be deprived of its equal suffrage or right to vote in the Senate. Period. End of subject. There's nothing else to talk about. And that's how they can fix it. So we're going to suggest that these states, as a matter of fact, we're going to tell these states they need to do it. It's not something that'd be nice to do. They need to do it. They owe it to the people. They owe it to themselves. They have to take control back. Okay.
So John. Before the 17th Amendment, the people didn't vote on the senators. Is that correct?
Yeah, the Senate, I believe the states worked it out themselves how they would do it, but I think most of them, and maybe Brent would know a little more than this, but I think what it was is that the governor would choose two senators, and the Congress, their Congress would vote on them, and I think that's how they chose them. But I guess they could choose any way they want. The point is that the legislators of the state, along with the governor, gets to decide who is the representative in the Senate for those states.
Well, what's very important about that is when they turned them into elected officials and made them subject to the political process,
right?
They gave them more power. In other words, you can't fire them now. You know, when they're appointed by a body, they can be disappointed. So if they
recall
the
next day, that's right.
And so that's right. So the point is that we send these guys up there, and now if you want to get rid of them, you have to impeach them. You got to do an Article 78. You got to do a bunch of voodoo. Before, we had more control. We were able to recall them if we didn't like what they were doing. Of course, that didn't give them very much, what do you want to call it, security, I guess, job security. And that's the way it should be. But
well, exactly. Well, look, they were there to do the will of the state. That's what they're
right.
There to represent the state. And so the legislators would really get to discuss what's going on and then say to the senators, okay, this is what we, the people, this is what we, the state, want to do. This is what the legislators of this state decided, and that's the vote you're going to carry. You're going to do that. They don't go up there to vote whatever it is they want, to go talk to special interest groups to make this, that, or the other thing. And now the same thing with the representatives in Congress for the people. Look, we live in a congressional district, and if we controlled the committee man process the way we should, and we're not happy with what's going on, the committee men can get together and say, look at how terrible these people are operating and doing these things. Let's get rid of them. Okay, let's walk the papers. We'll do a recall. 90 days later, they're out of office. If they're breaking the law, they're not obeying the Constitution, they're in bad behavior, they can be removed. They have the authority or the ability to serve as long as they are in good behavior. Good behavior is obedience to the Constitution ultimately, not stepping outside of their authority. Once they step outside of their authority, then they're in bad behavior. And bad behavior means we can remove them through the grand jury because now they're breaking the law. So we can remove them for the grand jury for breaking the law, or we can remove them by recall through the committee man process once we get that back. And we will get that back. I don't know how many people know that we're doing that also.
Do you think that would also help cure the other problem out there where the federal government says, we don't care what the state said, that particular activity or whatever you're doing there is against federal law, and we're going to enforce it anyway, whether it's legal in your state or not? Well, I mean, there's this confusion now where the federal government says, comes into the state and says, we don't want you to do that, where the state says you can do that. So they've created this battle and this inequality between, in other words, the federal government has now put itself above the states in certain laws and said we're going to enforce them regardless of what your state law says.
They stepped outside their authority. Again, you go to Section 8 of Article 1, which clearly lays out the authority and the powers of the state. Now, I mean, of the federal government, and they have authority in those areas. Look, it also in the Constitution, we the people gave the authority to the federal judicial system. In anything concerning the violation of someone's unalienable rights. Okay, when there is a right violation, it's the federal courts that need to hear that case, not the state courts. Okay, and so they do have an authority and a right and a power to deal with whatever powers we've given them. We've vested them with certain powers. But they've gone beyond that point, okay? And that's once they violate it and they step outside their authority, you know, by what authority? What are they acting upon? That's the question that we need to ask all the time. That's the question that every state needs to ask all the time. Hey, what authority are you acting under? And we don't want to know anything about a statute. We want you to lead us exactly. If you're going to lead us to a statute, you're going to now lead us to where that power of the authority of Congress was given that authority to create that statute. So you got to trace it all the way back to the authority given by the people, which comes back to the lawmaker, which is we the people. We wrote the Constitution. We made the law.
Well, I think that gets back to what Brent said, where they become the lawgiver. In other words, they have stepped up above what their authority is, and they're usurping our rights by becoming the lawgiver, and they're saying the law is what we tell you it is, basically.
Well,
anyway,
exactly.
It comes full circle, right?
And people, look, there's a lot of confused people out there thinking we have to have a constitutional convention. We gotta make another look, they're not even obeying the laws we've given them now. What makes anybody think they're going to obey more laws? And we're only going to confuse things, and this is what they want, more confusion, more contradiction, more problems, so that they can do more damage. Look, it's very simple. We've got the law already written. We got it here. Let's apply it. Let's make them obey it. And if they don't obey it, they got to leave office. Get out of town. That's what we need to do. And we're going to be able to start this process with what we're doing in the court cases right now that we're putting together and pressing that through that way. Okay. Now we got to push. We got to get to Trump and make sure he starts to push obedience to the marshals. Now, you know, the president cannot remove a marshal from office. The only way a marshal can be removed from office is he serves his term, and the president doesn't reinstate him. He brings another marshal in. That's one way. Another way, indictment. If a marshal is indicted, they're removed from office. Another way, of course, is that they resign. There's no other way. No judge can fire a marshal. The president can't get rid of a marshal. Nobody can get rid of a marshal, okay, except for the ways that I just said. And that's important that they have that ability. Otherwise, they'd be controlled. They're controlled by judges now. I think they fear the fact that the president or particularly a judge can get rid of them. I think that they fear that. I don't think they have any idea that they can't be fired. They can't be gotten rid of. And this is what we have to make clear. We have to really train or educate Trump in this. We have to look into Marbury versus Madison. We got to look into the Judiciary Act of 1789 and bring those two cases together, and also into our Constitution, and bring it full circle to show what the authority of the marshal is, how the marshal is actually really chosen, and then what's said in Marbury versus Madison, which they could not, the president has the power to appoint, but the Constitution does not give him the power to get rid of him. And if we did, that would be a huge mistake on our end, because then you'd have marshals controlled by an elected official, which we don't want. We want the marshal to be like a sheriff. But the marshal, if he's in bad behavior, we can get rid of him. So we need to start off with really getting the president behind us on this issue and start to push these marshals to obey the law. If we can work this out with Trump, this would be huge, because then once he puts forth his executive orders, which would be perfectly legal, he's telling them quite clearly, almost like a mandamus, but he's coming in an executive order saying, what's he telling them to do? Obey the law. And if you don't know the law, go learn the law. Here's where you can go. You can go somewhere else if you want, but here's where you can go to learn the law. Obey the law and enforce it. You don't work for the judges. You don't work for the any kind of a prison system. You don't work for the prosecutor. You work for we the people. You are here. You took an oath to uphold the Constitution, just like the sheriffs did. And if we can get that with what we're doing with the court case, we then can take control of the federal system, just judiciary system, just like we should have anyway. And then after that, it's a no-brainer, because of constitutional violations of due process being brought to jurisdictions unknown. The federal government, the federal judiciary has every right to go in and make that right, because that's what they were created for and given that authority to do that, to make sure that our unalienable rights are not being violated. So this can happen very quickly. I'll tell you what, if we can educate Trump to realize what needs to be done and to show him, and he's got to understand, he's got to have, he's got to be a president that's given rights back to the people where they belong, you know, to fix the problems. And he can do it. And he'll be a much better president for it. And then he'll be also being a influence to the next president after him. But once we the people get control, then that's it. We don't care if Hitler gets into the presidency. We don't care if Hitler gets into any of the legislative systems or even the court systems. We don't care, because either they're going to obey the law or they're going to be removed from office. It's that simple. So we don't have to worry about that. The evil in men's hearts won't affect us anymore as long as we hold them down to the chains of the Constitution.
So, look, the marshals and the sheriff, they work for we the people, and we understand why that is and how that is. Now, any other police force out there, be it a state police or a town police, if they're working for a corporate entity, basically. And the only thing that keeps them keeps us having any control over them is whether or not they take an oath to the Constitution. I think that's the only chain we have on them, because, you know, the state police become the private army of the governor. And I see that in New York, that he has his little elite team that he uses. But if it wasn't for them taking an oath to the Constitution, we would have no control over them whatsoever. We're going to do governor.
Look at if you apply the Constitution, okay, in the courts, that would bring it right down into even the town and the village courts. Pretty much everything they do in the town and village courts, almost everything, really is unconstitutional. We don't need a village court or a town court to make decisions. Maybe in small claims courts, we send that into the county court. Okay, which is really under the influence of the state court anyway. But nevertheless, that's where it can go. And if necessary, we can even put it into the state courts, which would be the Supreme Court of that state. But look at, once you get rid of a village court because, you know, you're saying, okay, you can't give the tickets out for this, you can't do this, you can't do that, at some point in time, they're not making a revenue. If they're not making a revenue, that court can't stay open. If that court can't stay open and can't make a revenue, then the police force starts to collapse. They can't have that either. That's got to go away. And you can get rid of all that system just by applying the law and making sure that these courts obey the law. If they want to run an administrative law, then when they get someone that's in there for some kind of a fine or something, you know, they got to explain to the people, hey, by the way, you know, if you don't want to participate, you can just walk out the door and we can't do nothing. They don't have the power, and it's clear, and the Supreme Court is clear on this quite often. They brought these points up, that they don't have the power to fine or incarcerate. Only a common law court can fine or incarcerate. So if you have a court that is, you know, a nisi prius court, which is administrative, unless you're in contract with them, an administrative contract, for instance, a person can sign up to agree with the Department of Labor's administrative process, you're kind of stuck in their system then, in their administrative system. You have to yield to it. And the court of the law of the land will enforce that through contract. So you have to obey it. But if you never signed up for it, then you can't be held to their administrative processes. It's the same thing with all these other courts. I mean, who signs up to say, well, okay, to all these towns, if I'm driving through your towns, I'm in good to give you a pay a fine if I go 5 miles over the speed limit or something like that? You know, we got a lot of contracts we'd have to do. Of course, we don't. They have no authority. All these systems fall apart. You know, when you get the state, even the state police give tickets out too. So there's a revenue process there also. So that'll affect them also. When they bring an individual that they have, brought up for speeding or something on a highway or a state road, and they bring it into the town for processing, the administrative process, that money that goes through the process, first of all, so part of that, all that money in those courts go to the state anyway. So all of that revenue will disappear, plus whatever it is, the extra percentages of the fact that they really created that revenue by the state police giving those tickets, I presume that's part of the process, so they make even more money. Remove the money system, all these other police forces start to fall apart. Then you'll only have private police forces, maybe in private, societies, or, you know, what would I call it, not a society, but... if you go down to Long Island, for instance, or you go out to the Connecticut side, for instance, of the bay there, you have all of these private police forces in these little communities, okay? And they're really, you know, they're really not a police force, ultimately. They don't have a court system anyway. They're really just, really a hired guard for the area. If they make an arrest, or ultimately they have to bring it to whatever authority is there, I guess the town or the village police department. So that'd be about the only place, and then the sheriff would then be able to pick up exactly what they should be doing, and that's the police force of the county. And each county has their own police force, ultimately, which is your sheriff system. You know, if there's a murder, you know, the sheriff would have to handle it. All these other things, it would all fall apart. Just close down the courts because they can't apply the law. They can't apply the fines or the incarcerations. All right, anyway, we didn't even enter into Q&A. So we're running late, but let's go into Q&A. If anyone has a question for Brent or anyone in particular, they can ask, but *6 to get into the queue, or if it's just a general question, we'll field it. Okay, first person, Eric there, you got the mic, go right ahead.
To Brent about the militia, I love the idea how people's certain skills come forward in certain emergencies, but... General Washington, or he might have been Colonel at the time, said discipline is the soul of an army. So if you don't hinder the creativity of an individual, how do you get the discipline into the militia? How are they well regulated? How would this be done by the state, if you know, or if you've had created your own?
Well regulated means regular, and regular means always ready, day in and day out. It means consistent. That's what the word meant then, and that's what it means now. It doesn't mean curtailed. It means consistent. Just like we say today, we distinguish between the regular Navy and the reserves. And the people that aren't reserves like to flaunt the idea they're regular Navy. What does that mean? That means they're always ready, day in and day out. I talked about my brother a while ago. He was in for many, many years, and when Desert Storm started, he was worked out of the Eisenhower building in England, and he was called to the general staff that they were planning how they were going to execute this invasion. And he told me later that the question came from the head man to the army, are you ready? And they said, we need 30 days to get ready, get mobilized, move. And he said to the admiral of the naval forces, are you ready? He said, I'm ready. And that's just the way it is between the army, between the land forces and the naval forces. The naval forces are really regular. And I've mentioned that just to draw the distinction and to make the point about what regularity is. The naval forces are always ready. It's the nature of ships at sea to be ready. There's no sense going to sea unless you're fully armed, fully manned, and ready to fight war. And all ships at sea that go on cruises are fully ready all the time. And that's the difference between the land forces. The land forces need time. So really the naval forces are more regular than the regular army, because of the nature of what they do, not because one's better than the other. That's not the point I'm making. It's just the nature of the way they both operate. And the militia of the several states to have the discipline, there's the difference, too. Of course, Washington, I understand his statement, and it does take discipline, but the militia of the several states is there so that they can make they're not conditioned to mechanical obedience. They're not conditioned to mechanical obedience. The militia of the several states are not professional military men. That's what we need. And I go for authority to that, and I haven't got to it yet. I'm trying to sort out how much detail to talk about when I get there. I go for authority for the militia of the several states, for the militia of the 12 tribes of Israel, because the detail of how they're to be governed and how they're to operate in war and out is complete. The book of Numbers especially, then some in the book called Deuteronomy, but Numbers especially. We're not left to wonder. And when you read those particular passages, the standards for the militia, you see the importance of the militia. And the difference between the militia and the standing army and our forebears, the men that ratified our Constitution, were very afraid of a standing army. And if you go to the Constitution, you discover that no standing army was to be funded for more than 2 years. They hated standing armies. They knew that they might be necessary in some circumstances. And remember, General Washington was of an aristocracy mindset. I'm not criticizing him just to criticize him, but he had his problems, in my humble opinion, in his views toward government. He had a lot of good things to say about his views toward government also. But he himself, his family, his grandfather came to Virginia because his grandfather didn't want his head chopped off, because his grandfather did not support the Parliament. He did not support the Republican form of government in England. He supported the crown, and the crown at that time was oppressive, and the divine right of kings ruled, and he believed in that. And George Washington is from that tradition. He was from Virginia. The two kinds of people in the American colonies, and the North-South line divided them to a great degree. There were the New Englanders. They were the people who had descended from the people that supported Oliver Cromwell. I'm speaking in very general terms, but generally that's true. They supported the power of Parliament. They supported a Republican form of government. And the people that migrated to old Virginia, those are the people, the old line, the old bloodlines, the old blue bloods, those are the people that supported the divine right of kings. And those two classes of persons descended from the same country came together and saw that they were both to a great degree wrong, that it was not Parliament that was sovereign, as it is now in England today. It is not the king that is sovereign. It is the co-equal branches of government, where none of the three branches trump the other. That's the conclusion to which they finally came, and they joined forces. But General Washington wanted the oath of the Continental Army to be to the United States, because the oath of all the men he had gathered to fight under him, under his command, their oaths were to the laws of their particular colonies. And it is of great significance that today in our own country, and I learned this when I was a very young fellow on the other side of the world, I found out that the oath I took was different than the oath of the Frenchman and the oath of even the Britishman, the British military man, not to mention the Australians and some of the Oriental countries, the South Koreans and the Japanese. They took an oath to a mere person, a mere frail man or woman, queen or a king or an emperor or an empress. I didn't do that. I took an oath to a set of principles written on a piece of paper. We call it the Constitution of the United States. Our oath in America is to the law of the land. Our oath is not to a person. But when we do that, you're taking an oath of loyalty to the lawgiver. You cannot take an oath to an impersonal piece of paper and the writing on it and have any meaning. Most young people, and I guess even older men that take the oath, don't have a clue what they're doing. It has become of no meaning. And it is true that the oath is what ties all of us together properly, and especially those that take positions in government. And it is the thing that gives us a handle on them, if anything does. Well, that's somewhat of a response. That's enough, I suppose, for now. And if I didn't cover it, I ask you to do two things. I came up with this idea. You can email me and say, well, I understood what you said, but you didn't hit the nail on the head, or I have a further question, or something like that. If you want to do that, and I'd try to get to it. If I'm given time, I'll try to answer it further.
All right. Well, please look out. I'm Eric in Georgia. Look out for it if you would. I appreciate
Eric,
it.
Sure, Eric. Thanks. Appreciate you.
Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to follow up on that. You know, there was the Militia Act of 1792, then the Militia Act of 1862, and then I think the last one was in 1903. And in 1903, Chapter 196, an act to promote the efficiency of the militia and for other purposes. And it says here, be it enacted by the Senate and House representatives of the United States of America and Congress assembled, that the militia shall consist of every able-bodied male citizen of the respective states, territories, and the District of Columbia, and every able-bodied male of foreign birth who has declared his intention to become a citizen who is more than 18 and less than 45 years of age, and into two classes, the organized militia, to be known as the National Guard of the state, territory, or District of Columbia, or by such other designations as may be given them by the laws of the representative states or territories, and the remainder to be known as the reserved militia. Now, so that looks like there's the organized militia and the unorganized, and I'm presuming you call it the unorganized militia in a sense, because they're not normally organized. Now, the way this is set up, is this constitutional, the way this is set up? Now, I know they're lacking the constitutional responsibilities, and I'm saying the Congress is lacking it because, first of all, the armories, if they've done anything, they've been closing them down. They need to reopen the armories, restock them, and then I would imagine every person needs to, every able-bodied male needs to show up for a call, maybe, I don't know, a certain number of days or weeks out of the year. in order to just get their base. And everyone, I presume, at 18 should be And I haven't read through all this. Maybe this is already in there. But I'm presuming the process should be everyone should go through a boot camp, whether it be 2 months or 3 months as the militia at age 18. And then every year, I would presume, that they should show up for some training, maybe 2 weeks out of the year, every 6 months, a week, or something. And then you have the organized militia, which they're calling the National Guard, okay, where I presume they sign up for a two-year, sign up for 2 years or whatever the length of time is, where they're actually in sort of a service of as the militia in the state, where they have some processes and duties that they're working through, and of course they're ready to protect the state. So is this or is this not constitutional? Although they're still failing us, but is this not the beginning of a constitutional process, or is there a problem with this idea of National Guard?
I would say there's a serious problem. You're referring to that legislation was called the DICK Act. D-I-C-K. Now, I'm shooting from the hip a little bit, but I remember what I know about Mr. Dick. He was one of those kind of fellows that knew everything, and if you didn't believe it, just ask him. I'm just trying to state the facts. I'm not being critical. I've been accused of the same thing. But Mr. Dick had a real reputation for that, and it is unconstitutional. The National Guard is constitutionally unknown. Our Constitution knows nothing of such an animal. The problem with the National Guard is it's not the militia of the several states for a number of reasons. One of the greatest would be that the federal government or the state government provides the weapons and the training, and that's not what a militia is. A militia is where you provide your own weapons and your own training. And the other thing the DICK Act does that's unconstitutional, it divides.
Yeah, but before you go further, further on that, just to keep up, on what you're saying here, if you go into Article 1, Section 8, and again, I don't have a good understanding of this. That's why I'm asking you here. If you go there and you go into, I think it's Clause 16, it says to provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such parts of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states, respectively, the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Wouldn't that be therefore what they've done here? I know there's the Militia Act of 1792, which I haven't read yet, but I've skimmed through a little pieces here or there, but I just haven't had the time to study. And then there's another, I think it's 18, let me see if I can find that. There was another Militia Act of 1862, okay? Would that be more constitutional? Have you read through those three acts?
The DICK Act I have read, but not the 1862 Act, and I've read some of the local colonial acts from way back and tried to follow some of that through. But the DICK Act has created a division, too, that's constitutionally unknown, organized and unorganized militia. And what the DICK Act is saying is we've divided the militia into two classes, the ones that join the National Guard, and then there's everybody else that doesn't want to participate. That's not what the militia is. The militia is every man, and every man by law, who's able-bodied over a particular age, I say age 20 is a good age, to bear a weapon in battle, a military-grade weapon, is the militia of the several states. And then divide them into two classes and say these folks receive this training. That the thing you read a while ago was right. The Congress is to provide, according to the four militia clauses, provide the discipline that the states are to use. The Congress has no power in that. They're just to draw up the law and give it to the states. The states then, how they do it, and of course, you'd mentioned that's right up the states appoint officers, not the federal government. But the whole DICK Act, just it just twisted things off center kind of like a crystal that has a couple of molecules.
Yeah, but where could we get stabilized in this? I mean, look, Congress had a job to do. Have they ever really done the job to make sure that they've, you know, executed the authority that they were vested with in Clause 16? Where do we find that? And look, this is what I'm thinking. And again, uh-huh. It sounds logical to me from reading this and then seeing a little bit of what I've read here. It sounds logical that each state has to have a certain amount of people that are constantly, you know, 24/7, they're in some kind of a service of the militia to keep guard, okay? Whatever, if you want to call them the National Guard or call them something else or the organized militia, okay? And whether they sign up for a year, 2 years, or whatever the case may be, and I guess they can re-up if they want, but you have a certain percentage of people that need to be there. Then you have the rest of the people that need to have at least been trained at some point in time. If the age is 18, at age 18, they need to go to a boot camp or something to be trained in the militia. So now they have that training, okay? And now they're not in the organized militia, so they're not serving every day unless they want to join that. And I would presume, though, that these people, being us, all of us, in order to be kept up and practiced and so on, so every so often we need to go and participate in an organized process, maybe for a weekend or a week or a couple of days, every so often or something of that. Isn't that the proper way to look at this? And, of course, the officers are in full time, of course, and I would presume at that point career-driven, you know?
Yeah, that's a problem, too. But you mentioned also, see, when people join the National Guard, they go to a federal boot camp, and I would say that's unconstitutional also.
Absolutely, I would agree too, yes.
Yeah. So the Dick Act mixes up federal and state jurisdiction, blurs the lines, and it essentially federalizes what they call the National Guard. But most fundamentally, there's no division between an organized and unorganized militia. What that says is, you fellas here, we'll pay you. You come on and be part of our professional group, and you'll be semi-full-time or quasi-professional, and the rest of you don't have to do anything. And once you do that, you've destroyed the effectiveness of the militia of the several states according to the law of the Constitution. And the Constitution, I like to cite what the Bible says about the militia. Probably mentioned it before. There's a place in the Bible, or a lot of places in the Old Testament, where Moses gets really scared and upset because people are against him. And one time he goes to God himself and he prays and he said, Lord, you don't understand what's going on here. These people are hungry, they're mad, and there are over 600,000 armed men here. He's talking about the militia because they numbered them, 603,550 when they came out of Egypt, armed in ranks. And so there were over 600,000 by that time, something like that. And Moses, the chief man in government, was afraid of them. That's what God wants. That's the way God designed it. That's how he operates. And if you start dividing them up and send them off to federal boot camp and providing weapons and training
and
money.
Well, I agree with you on that. They can't do that. The states have got to take the responsibility of that, each state. Mm-hmm. But again, Congress seems to have neglected this duty and authority that they've got. Is that not correct? Or there is no... What exactly does Congress have to do? I don't want you to answer this now because we're at the end of the evening, but I want you to think about this, and maybe we could talk a little bit about this next Monday. What exactly do we think Congress needs to do? Because we have to address this problem in our paperwork that we're going to be filing, and we need to know what we need to tell Congress that is proper, maybe by looking again into history, which you seem to have looked quite deeply into, to see how it is that we can guide Congress to do the right thing and to give them some kind of a framework to be thinking about and putting things together. But again, my logic came out, what I was trying to lay out. It seems like there's got to be a certain number of people in the state constantly on call on duty that they sign up for a year or two or three. And then everyone else needs to, from time to time, come in for a little training throughout their entire life, at least between the age of 18 and 45, which is one of the things, or whatever the ages need to be at, you know. I presume that's the logical main part of this whole thing, right? Whether we call them the National Guard or maybe we should stick with the name of the organized militia. Maybe that's what they should be called.
Well,
the organized
one thing
militia of the state of whatever.
I'm not going to answer the question then, but I'm going to go back, and maybe somebody else is listening and want to do it. I'm sure I went through those things a long time ago. We've all forgotten them. But I went through the responsibilities of Congress. I'm going to go back to the website that you fellows have set up and see if that recording is still there.
And, yeah, and back in the beginning especially, we were very specific in detail.
But we wouldn't be able to find. We just have to, by trial and error, open them up and see which ones it was. But
I'd like to do is kind of get a list of what Congress needs to do. Look, we have every place I know of armories. I know of quite a few armories down in New York City. They're no longer armories. They're vacant. There's nothing in them. They've been empty for a very long time. We have one in Poughkeepsie here. It's empty. I mean, it's closed up. It's empty. Nothing there. I mean, look, these armories need to be filled and supplied. You know, everybody, again, like you say, should have their own weapon. It's their responsibility to buy their weapon, own it, and have the necessary, ammunition or whatever. But nevertheless, there's other equipment that has to be supplied by, I presume, the state, again. I'd have to look at the Constitution again to see if it says organizing, arming. It's up to the federal government to arm all the state armories
the Congress just has the responsibility to pass legislation to govern. We would call it maybe the Uniform Code of Military Justice. They're to provide that to the states, and then Congress doesn't have any other authority, neither does the president. States do everything else.
The states have to get weaponry.
That's an individual responsibility, but you're talking about heavy artillery and trucks.
Right,
and like
cannons,
that.
Heavy artillery, whatever you have, that kind of stuff. Someone has to supply that, and people need to be practiced in it. They need to, and they need to be available in every community where people can go and to the armory and get armed with the heavy artillery or whatever special weaponry is there. But again, everyone should have their own arms. As far as an automatic weapon and a handgun,
If every American were armed according to the rules of their state legislature, every able-bodied American, that would go a long way.
We'd never have to worry about anything. Anybody
heavy artillery and all that, you wouldn't need to worry about as much. First step is just to use the four militia clauses, put them into practice. And we can talk about that next time, maybe. And I'll go back and review all that.
I'd like to talk a little bit about that and maybe try to ask if you might want to. We'd like to get something written up, but not in heavy detail, not long-winded, because our paperwork, we want to keep it minimum, but we want to, make bullet points, the responsibility of Congress that they have not been taken, their duty. They haven't been doing their duty. They're not responsible. They need to become responsible. What is it that they have to do? We need to lay that out. What is it the states have to do? We need to lay that out, too. We need to let the governors know that they need to be talking with their Congress in their own states and fix this problem.
A short explanation of 100 pages, and I've got the book, Militia of the Several States, with a Model State Militia Statute in the back. The Model State Militia Statute, and I drafted it up with attention to those things, the four militia clauses and the four classes of persons and what their duties are, federal government, state government, president, and, of course, the militia members under the Second Amendment. That's all there. It's called the Militia of the Several States, our Constitution's answer to its enemies. You can find that at commonlawyer.com. I think at Amazon.com, too.
Thank you, Brent. Thank you. I want to thank you, too, because you really clarified that whole oath question, who the oath is for, to.
Idea,
and that's what I was getting at. That's the hold we have on the other members out there, that they have that oath to the law and the lawgiver, and that's what they need to understand. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity, and it's my pleasure. We'll talk again, I hope.
All right. Does anybody else have a final statement, Gerard, or anything else before we close up? We're running late anyway, so.
I'm done.
Okay. Looking for the song that I had was going to put on today. Oh, here it is. Okay, I got it. Okay. All right, we're going to close down. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. And again, we're going to start sending out some information concerning trying to collect the people to get everyone involved in some way, to take the opportunity here of what's happening in the political process, the pressures on the political process to the powers that be and into the judiciary and the paperwork we're doing. Now is the time to push. We need everybody into the game, doing something, getting educated, and preparing to take control of our nation. If we don't step up and do it, it's not going to be done. Okay, good night, everybody.
All right.
Good night.